You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
So what I'm absolutely convinced of is at Göbekli Tepe, we've captured the period in time that transitions from the end of the last ice age to post-ice age conditions. And this occurred based on the ice core data, not in several years, not in a decade, not even over several months, but the ice age, we snapped out the ice age in a matter of weeks or days or literally overnight. So it was very, very sudden, very, very catastrophic, which would tie in with the solar outburst, which is just going to hit us being the Earth, immediately.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Robert Schock. Today's show, Robert Schock and the Solar-Induced Dark Age. Robert Schock is a tenured faculty member at Boston University. He earned his doctorate in geology and geophysics at Yale University. His research, put forth in his book, Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future, points to the astronomical cause of the demise of antediluvian civilization, as well as the scientific and archaeological evidence that supports his conclusions. He is well known for his work in Egypt, redating the Sphinx back 12,000 years. Initially, he was criticized for his research because there was no evidence of other civilizations dating back that far until the discovery of the archaeological site of Göbekli Tepe, a very sophisticated version of Stonehenge in southeastern Turkey, where we resume our conversation with Dr. Schock. Dr. Robert Schock, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Haven't you written that these sophisticated pillars at Göbekli Tepe, they're anthropomorphic in the sense that they have belts, they have arms, they have hands holding their bellies, but their orientation is toward the sky. Isn't that right?
That is absolutely correct. I'm glad you brought that up because this ties in with precession also. Just as we have the Sphinx, I believe, oriented toward Leo in the sky on the vernal equinox, so that is referring to precessional ages, at Göbekli Tepe, we have, and I should mention this now because sometimes I forget to mention things because it's almost second nature to me. At Göbekli Tepe, we don't have one Stonehenge-like circle or set of pillars. There are 20 or more there that have been found geophysically, and it could be even larger. It's a huge site. A good chunk of 4-plus parts of others have been excavated so far. So this is not one Stonehenge-like site. It's as if you have Stonehenge multiplied by a couple of dozen, minimally. It's just a huge site. It was buried intentionally over 10,000 years ago. I believe the reason it was buried was because of the catastrophes at the end of the last ice age. We actually have evidence of breakage of the pillars at the end of the last ice age, and they were trying to hastily re-erect them, that type of thing. So we have, I believe, actual physical evidence of the catastrophes at the end of the last ice age. Getting to the orientations, returning to the orientations of the pillars, the anthropomorphic pillars look in the general direction of south. But when you look at exactly where they're looking in the sky at the end of the last ice age and that period, they seem to be looking at Orion, the area of Orion and Taurus in the Pleiades on the vernal equinox. That is not a precessional age per se. They seem to be oriented toward that region of the sky. And as precession changed the orientation of the sky on the vernal equinox, they re-erected the pillars, they built other circles, other stone enclosures, and reoriented them over time to follow the processional changes. So this, again, is very, very sophisticated. It takes a lot of time and energy to do that. They were evidently following things in the sky, recording processional changes, making note of that over, by my estimate, at least a 2,000-year period, and that's only based on what's been excavated so far. It's interesting that it's Orion that they're orienting things to, because my colleague, Robert Bouval, is very, very well known for what is called the Orion Correlation Theory of the Giza Plateau, that even as the Sphinx during the age of Leo was looking at Leo in the sky on the vernal equinox, the entire Giza Plateau has a correlation to Orion. That is, that the three major pyramids, the Great Pyramid, the Second Pyramid, and the Third Pyramid, on the Giza Plateau in their orientation mimic the belt stars of Orion in the sky at about 10,000 to 11,000 BC. They match up perfectly relative to the Milky Way, where on the ground the Milky Way is the Nile, and everything lines up perfectly. If people want a review of that in the latest discussion, Robert Bouval and I talk about that in our joint book, Origins of the Sphinx, that came out last year. But you have these Orion correlations on the Giza Plateau. You have Orion correlations at the same time following precession at Göbekli Tepe. So I think that's probably more than coincidence at this point. I was sort of embarrassed initially when I found Orion correlations at Göbekli Tepe, because I didn't want people to think I was looking at that specifically just to compare it to Giza, but I'm convinced they're absolutely there. And Orion seems to be something that was very important to the ancients. It's talked about even in the Judeo-Christian Bible, the Orion Pleiades Taurus region of the sky, and you have it there at Göbekli Tepe. I also want to point out that those pillars, those anthropomorphic pillars, they lack a head. The Göbekli Tepe people could have carved a head if they wanted to. There are smaller statues and whatnot. There's what's sometimes known as a totem pole, carved out of stone that was found at Göbekli Tepe that you can now see in the Urfa Museum. There are other smaller statues and whatnot. Some of them are anthropomorphic, and they have heads. They could carve human heads if they wanted to. But they didn't put it on those central pillars of what's known as Enclosure D, one of the major enclosures. Those central pillars are anthropomorphic. They have hands. They have arms. One of them actually has a little dog-like animal under one of the arms that could refer to the dog star and the constellations associated with it. And those pillars, one in particular, has a really, really prominent, beautifully carved belt and loincloth. So one possible interpretation is that these central pillars actually are mimicking Orion in the sky. And if you look at the constellation Orion, it is the headless hunter, if you would. It's essentially a torso with well-defined belt stars. In modern terms of the constellation, people have the arms up in the sky, holding maybe a club or something. But those are secondary to the actual asterism of the belt stars in the torso. I would say even if they acknowledge those arms, you couldn't carve those in a pillar. They brought them down to the sides, if you would, metaphorically. But what's important is you've got the belt stars but lacking the head, or are the head only shown very, very abstractly. It's actually shown abstractly, I would say, on the pillars, but not well defined. So this could be Orion, shown in stone, and what you have around those central pillars, you have a ring of pillars all carved with different animals. So you've got Orion in the sky, surrounded by the zodiac, surrounded by animals in the sky, if you would, the constellations of the zodiac. That's what zodiac means. It's really the constellations of the zoo, the animals. And you've got the same thing in the enclosures at Göbekli Tepe. You've got, perhaps in stone, essentially a model of the sky from their perspective.
You have written that Göbekli Tepe was used and reused for 2,000 years and then intentionally covered over around 8,000 BC. So, well, I guess what you're saying is that it was damaged, badly damaged. They tried to repair it, and then they covered the whole thing up. Is that right?
Correct. That's correct, because I believe, and when I say I believe, it's always based on evidence. I want to stress that. It's not just, I don't want to sound the wrong way, but it's not just, you know, my random belief. It's based on the evidence. When you look at Göbekli Tepe, one can see very strong evidence, really quite obvious, on the ground that some of these pillars were knocked over in ancient times. They then tried to re-erect them hastily. You can see how they propped them back up again. They actually built stone walls, very crude stone walls, between the pillars to sort of prop up the pillars and hold them together. There has been, quote, mortar and sort of a plaster-like substance that has been taken, sampled from those stone walls that dates them back to the end of the last ice age. So what I'm absolutely convinced of is at Göbekli Tepe, we've captured the period in time that transitions from the end of the last ice age to post-ice age conditions. And this occurred, based on the ice core data, not in several years, not in a decade, not even in over several months, but the ice age, we snapped out the ice age in a matter of weeks or days or literally overnight. So it was very, very sudden, very, very catastrophic, which would tie in with the solar outburst, which is just going to hit us being the Earth, immediately. It's not something that's initially prolonged. You might have so-called more, you know, the effects would be profound and last over time, but the initial hit, the initial shock would be literally just in a matter of hours. So getting back to Göbekli Tepe, we can see where the pillars were broken. They were knocked down. They were hastily re-erected. And they seem to have been trying to do this, the Göbekli Tepe people, to put things back together, to orient things again. We can see that they were trying to orient the pillars, put them back into their proper orientation. And ultimately, my speculation is that things were so difficult, so profoundly catastrophic and traumatic at the time, that I don't want to say they gave up, but they decided that this was just not working. This is at least one possibility, and they decide to just bury the site completely. My speculation is that they buried it completely, perhaps with the intention of coming back and uncovering it again, one way to protect the site. And they do this with modern archaeological sites sometimes. They'll excavate them, then they'll rebury them for protection. So they might have covered it over to protect it with the concept of coming back to uncover it and reassemble it properly, or maybe they buried it essentially as a time capsule for, you know, hopefully posterity to uncover, which we've now done over 10,000 years later. The time when they covered it at least 10,000 years ago. It may be longer than that, maybe somewhat closer to the end of the last ice age. But they were trying for at least some period of time to reassemble it and put it back together before they decided to bury the entire site. And once they buried it, it really kept it nice and pristine. So that's one reason we have such good evidence at Göbekli Tepe. As I said before, unlike the Great Sphinx, and this has been one of my issues with dealing with the Sphinx, technical issues, the Sphinx has a lot of overlay of reuse and refurbishing, being repaired, that type of thing. Once Göbekli Tepe is buried and covered over purposefully over 10,000 years ago, no one touched it, no one changed anything until now that it's being uncovered by archaeologists.
I'm speaking with geologist and professor Dr. Robert Schock. Today's show, Robert Schock and the Solar-Induced Dark Age. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that the Cappadocia region of modern Turkey is where the soft volcanic bedrock was conducive to the excavation of extensive underground shelters and indeed entire cities. You showed slides of these sites. They were quite dramatic. These pictures were quite extraordinary. Do you think people lived underground, and if so, for how long?
Yeah, I have no doubt people lived underground. And what you have to realize is that at the end of the last ice age, with these solar outbursts, with these catastrophic changes, not only did you have all kinds of flooding, not only did you have fires being set on the surface where essentially think of huge lightning bolts coming down that can set fires to anything flammable. It can be incredibly destructive. You also had the stripping of the ozone layer, the ionosphere, the magnetosphere. So we can calculate, and not myself, but physicists I know who I've talked to about this, calculated that you could have very high levels of radiation on the surface of the Earth at the end of the last ice age with all this catastrophe on top of everything else that was happening. Also, a lot of volcanic activity in places where the Earth is conducive to that, earthquakes worldwide would have been induced, not only because you relieve the pressure on the surface of the Earth from, when huge masses of ice are melted at high latitudes, but it's also been found now, and this is counterintuitive for a lot of classic geologists, but it's been found that earthquake activity correlates with solar activity. So when you have massive solar events and outbursts, this will correlate with earthquake activity on Earth, on the planet, as well as volcanic activity. It seemed to set it off. In many cases, this is all side notes in a way, but it builds up the bigger picture. In some cases, you can think of an avalanche that's about to occur. It's going to occur one time or another, but when someone claps or makes a noise, it's that final trigger that sets off the avalanche. It may be the case for earthquakes that they're going to occur eventually, but when you have solar activity disrupting electrical currents, and there are lots of electrical currents and whatnot in the Earth underground, that can be sort of the trigger that sets off earthquakes that would eventually happen. So it was very tumultuous at the time. But getting back to the radiation would have been devastating for large mammals. So large mammals could not tolerate the high levels of radiation. In some cases, exposure for even a week or so may have caused them to die of essentially radiation poisoning, cosmic rays, that type of thing coming in that we would normally be protected from. One way to escape such effects is to go under rocks, to go underground, to go into caves, that type of thing. So we have both large mammals going extinct and a massive extinction of large mammals at the end of the last ice age, very well documented, particularly in North America, exactly at the end of the last ice age. Humans, in some cases, were devastated. Populations were devastated. In other cases, because there were natural caves or other natural features like soft rock that had caves in them, natural caves, and then once you have a natural cave and you go into it, you can extend that cave artificially as necessary, et cetera, this would be a way to escape it. And you might not know in ancient times, 12,000 years ago, what radiation is. You can't feel it, you can't see it, etc. But you would still be inclined to go into caves when, you know, this huge lightning is coming down in torrential rains and everything else. So even if they didn't know what radiation was, they probably were going into caves when they had a chance. And it was those pockets of people that could survive. And I believe that during the Siddha period following this solar-induced dark age, for thousands of years, there was plenty of memory of what had happened, what had gone on. And in fact, there were smaller solar outbursts, sort of like aftershocks of a major earthquake, where people were reminded of what was happening and what had happened. And we have that data in the isotope records that the sun had this incredible outburst, but there was still a lot of activity for centuries and millennia after that, after the end of the last ice age. So getting back to something like Cappadocia, there is a region where people could escape into natural caves initially. They then got the concept that, well, we better be prepared if this happens again. So they carved further into the rock. The rock was very amenable to that. It's a relatively soft rock. It protects well from these types of events. So they prepared themselves. And in fact, if you have it, you might as well live in it in some cases, which may have been the case in Cappadocia. But it all really goes back to the end of the last ice age and what was happening there. I also want to point out with Cappadocia, we have, for instance, linguistic evidence that there was a constriction of the population at the end of the last ice age. There was a pocket of people that survived at the end of the last ice age, and we can trace this linguistically to the Cappadocia region, and that apparently there was a group of people that survived there speaking a language which was a predecessor, essentially what we now think of the Indo-European languages, and then they spread out again and repopulated the more general area spreading out from the Cappadocia region.
Well, now, Dr. Shock, just before your first visit to Göbekli Tepe, you visited, along with your wife and some other people from Chile, you visited Easter Island. And Easter Island has a lot to do with the story of Göbekli Tepe. What is the standard and conventional archaeological explanation for the Moai statues on Easter Island? I think people are pretty familiar with them, those very stout, thick, huge statues found all over this extremely small island.
Yeah, it's an extremely small island. Easter Island is a beautiful little island. It's very remote, sometimes rightfully called the most remote inhabited place on Earth, because it's in the South Pacific, not very far south into the Pacific, but it's incredibly remote, thousands of kilometers from any other inhabited area. And it's a really amazing place. But what it's known for, first and foremost, are the Moai, these big torsos and heads that are all over the island, all over parts of the island. And they were carved out of the volcanic rock there. And the standard explanation, actually, one archaeologist said to me that they were busy work. Because you had a small island population, you had to keep everyone under control, so it's sort of like a public works project. And the leaders had them carve these big statues to keep them busy, and of course it's a little more complicated than that, even the classic archaeologists would say. They would say that, you know, they were idols, or they were represented the ancestors or whatnot. The standard archaeological explanation, if you don't know what something is, it's either a temple or a tomb or some kind of religious object. But the point is that, you know, it's a very difficult thing. I'm actually teaching a course right now, and I get into this at Boston University, that's very difficult to interpret the past, especially when you're not in that mindset. You know, it's a big mistake to take our mindset and try to impose it onto another culture, another civilization. And the other thing about Easter Island is that the conventional archaeological view is that it was not inhabited until very recent times from my perspective as a geologist. When I say very recent times from my perspective, archaeologists often talk about Easter Island first being inhabited by other Polynesians, so Polynesians coming from the west, moving east, that this is the last outpost of Polynesia, and they didn't get to Easter Island until maybe 500 AD, maybe as late as 800, some have even suggested 1200 AD. So very, very recent, well within the last 2,000 years. I question all of this. I will bring up some people will remember him or know of him, Thor Heyerdahl, for instance, who argued very strenuously that there was a South American influence on Easter Island, that people from South America may have influenced Easter Island as well as Polynesians, so there was an influence from both the East and the West. I would go even further than that and say maybe Easter Island and its civilization and culture goes back much, much, much earlier and may have influenced both South America and the rest of Polynesia. So, a couple of things about Easter Island to touch on very, very quickly. I think there's evidence that it goes back much earlier. Civilization on Easter Island goes back much earlier. I believe we have sedimentological evidence in pollen, basically fossil pollen, evidence going back much earlier for human habitation on Easter Island. Where I'm going with that is plants that were brought to Easter Island that had to be brought by humans. When you look at some of the moai, they are buried up to their necks and chins in sediment. I don't buy the standard argument that they just dug big holes and stuck them in. The holes up to their chins after they carved the bodies with beautiful hands, hands that go to the navel, just like we see in Turkey. In fact, there are many similarities in the iconography of the moai and statues that we see in Turkey that go back to Göbekli Tepe times. This is something I actually show in the color insert of Forgotten Civilization. I have a picture of moai, and you can compare that to the pillars with the hands and belt and framing the navel that we see at Göbekli Tepe. There's something, or a statue known as Urfa Man that was found at Urfa that goes back to Göbekli Tepe times in Turkey that I believe has iconographic similarities, same type of, should we say, symbolism and placement of the hands and arms, etc., as we have at Göbekli Tepe. So these are all very intriguing. If some of the moai were buried in meters and meters and meters of sediment, this suggests to me geologically that they are much older than just a couple of thousand years old, that they go back to a much, much earlier age.
I'm speaking with geologist and professor Dr. Robert Schock. Today's show, Robert Schock and the Solar-Induced Dark Age. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Another thing that I would point out, and there's actually a lot of evidence, more than we can probably cover now, is that some of the moai are not as big and not as impressive from that point of view, but even more impressive from another point of view because they're not carved out of relatively soft volcanic tufts, or what's known as tuffa stone or tufts, which is a relatively soft volcanic rock by, you know, geological standards. There are a few moai that are carved out of really beautiful, fine, hard, dense basalt. And perhaps the finest one no longer resides in Easter Island because it was taken to the British Museum in the late 19th century and has lived there ever since. But these basalt moai, a couple of things about them. They have consistently been found at very, very deep archaeological levels, which would suggest that they're older than the other moai. They have also been found, the British Museum one, for instance, was found in a context where it was being reused. It was even recarved on the back a little bit, which it sounds similar to the Sphinx being reused and recarved. So again, that indicates it itself originally goes back to an earlier period. And I'm also convinced that the basalt quarries where these had to be quarried in order to carve them, where they found the huge, good, carvable blocks of basalt, not just smaller fragments of basalt, but big blocks that could be carved into these statues, in particular the statue now in the British Museum, have not been found on the island, even though it's a very, very small island. You can cover it very quickly. The geological evidence, in my opinion, suggests that these basalt quarries are probably now underwater, that they're on the edge of the island, stratigraphically lower, geographically lower, and they were exposed at one time when sea levels were lower at the end of the last ice age. Since then, sea levels have risen, buried these quarries, but that would suggest, again, that the moai that are carved from that basalt go back to a much earlier period, unless you want to speculate that they're going underwater to quarry basalt, which would be, should we say, really, really, really difficult, even with modern scuba diving equipment, etc., much less back in ancient times. And there's even evidence, talking to some of the Easter Islanders when Katie and I have been there on some of our trips, that they say they remember the late Jacques Cousteau and his crew when they were looking around the edge of the island underwater. They seem to have found what looked like very regular, rectangular-type structures in basalt off the coast that, to me, are suggestive of potential quarries. So there's lots of things going on along those lines with Easter Island, but I want to get to something very, very important about Easter Island, and that is that there are petroglyphs on Easter Island. And there is a Rongo Rongo script on Easter Island. It's the only, quote, Polynesian, unquote, island that has its own indigenous script. It's known as the Rongo Rongo, and this ties in with petroglyphs and ties in with the end of the last ice age very, very explicitly. I have to mention another researcher now, and that is Dr. Anthony Perrott, and he's at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he has independently looked at what I would date to the end of the last ice age. He simply puts it at a remote period in time, but we can translate to end of the last ice age. He also has put together evidence that there was a major solar outburst, a major solar event in what he calls remote prehistory, and something that he found was, and I've since confirmed this and agree with him on it, is that at that ancient time, and I'll use my terminology, end of the last ice age, when the solar outburst occurred, people saw things in the sky. So nowadays, people can think of, at very high latitudes, the aurora borealis, the northern lights are in the south, the southern lights, and you see things in the sky. This has to do with plasma electrical particles hitting the magnetosphere, hitting the atmosphere, interacting the different atoms and whatnot, interacting in it, and it makes what looks like lights in the sky. These are just pretty things in the sky nowadays. No one thinks of them as being harmful normally, although if it's strong enough, it can affect communication systems, satellites, that type of thing. At the end of the last ice age, you had this, but I hate to use the term, but as if it were on steroids. So you had what we would think of as northern and southern lights, but much, much, much more intense. Also being so intense, they were seen around the globe, not just at high latitudes. And also becoming very intense, they started to take on very diagnostic shapes, very distinct patterns and shapes, which humans tend to see things in shapes, and that's how we visualize, that's how we see things, that's how we remember. These particular shapes that would form would look sort of like stick figures, human stick figures, and Dr. Perrott has established this. His specialty is plasma physics, studying such things. And he established this theoretically and in the laboratory some decades ago. He, as he described it to me himself once, and he talks about this in his publications, he also, as a hobby, was looking at petroglyphs, carvings on rocks by ancient people. Las Almas is out in the west, and there you have petroglyphs on the rocks. He would look at these, go out for walks and rides just as a hobby, and he put two and two together. What he was seeing on some of the rocks from very ancient times were essentially depictions of plasma configurations that you would see in the sky during a solar outburst. So if that all makes sense, they effectively, at the end of the last ice age, were seeing things in the sky, and some people actually drew depictions of what they were seeing on rocks that we now call petroglyphs. Katie and I and John Anthony West, before he passed away, for instance, we did a conference. We attended and spoke at a conference in Norway, and we got a chance to go and see petroglyphs in Norway that are well dated to the end of the last ice age. They had all the diagnostic depictions, all the diagnostic features of what you would see in the sky during a major solar outburst. And this is not just theoretical, because there was a small, by astrophysical perspectives, a small solar outburst in 1859 known as the Carrington event, and people drew and people recorded what they saw in the sky at that time, and it was the same types of images, the same types of figures. Some look like stick figures of humans. Some look like cascading ring structures. I talk about this in Forgotten Civilization. I think there's some images on my website so people can take a look at that. Going back to Easter Island, returning to our discussion of Easter Island, you have petroglyphs on Easter Island, but even more importantly, you have the Rongo Rongo script. And Katie, my wife, actually first made the connection that the Rongo Rongo glyphs, if you would, they sort of look like hieroglyphs. People think of them as hieroglyphs. They are the same thing. They are also showing what was in the sky. They're basically depictions of what you would see in the sky during a major solar outburst. So the Easter Islanders or their ancestors seem to have recorded this, and then the actual Rongo Rongo nowadays, when I say nowadays, in the ones that have survived, they're known as Rongo Rongo tablets. They're carved on wood. They don't go back to the end of the last ice age, but they're copies of copies of copies of what was recorded at that remote period of time. Not unlike Plato's dialogues. For many of Plato's dialogues, the oldest manuscript we have is only 1,000 or so years old, but it's a copy of a copy of a copy. So we have some very important evidence recorded and preserved, I believe, through the Easter Island culture of what was happening at the end of the last ice age.
Yes, the Rongo Rongo glyphs that are copied onto wood, and also the petroglyphs, which are carved in stone, and those are found worldwide. They're found everywhere.
They're found everywhere. Dr. Perot and his team have documented the exact same configurations, the exact same glyphs in 130-plus countries around the world.
Yes, that's right. So that's corroborated by the Rongo Rongo glyphs. Is there evidence of this type of glyph in Göbekli Tepe?
Yes, we have actually similar types of things from Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, even on some of the pillars, which would have been carved or recarved, you know, at the end of the last ice age as all this catastrophe was occurring. Sort of, sometimes they're referred to as weird, You know, like there's one that some people interpret as maybe a person giving birth, that type of thing. You know, we tend to anthropomorphize them. There are symbols that look like they're referring to plasma and lightning. There are sort of H-type symbols that probably actually refer to, again, as Dalai's version, what was happening in the sky. There are other texts, when I say texts, carvings from Turkey, not necessarily specifically Göbekli Tepe, but other sites in the general area that record, in fact, glyphs that are incredibly similar to what you see on Easter Island, the Rongo Rongo. In fact, some people, one suggestion, this is an old suggestion, but I bring it up for a different reason. Some people, I want to say in the 40s or 30s, have even suggested that the Rongo Rongo was somehow connected to Asia and the Near East because they saw similarities between the Rongo Rongo glyphs and different inscriptions that they saw in the Turkey through India region. I don't think it's that one copied the other. I think it's that both of them are these diverse cultures, I should say. We're seeing similar things in the sky, each interpreting them in their own way to a certain extent, sort of stylistically, but they were all based on the same natural phenomenon at the end of the last ice age in the sky. On the Giza Plateau, and this is just very, very recent evidence now, I have found, and I do mention this on my website, it was shown to me by a couple of my colleagues, Egyptological colleagues, these strange rocks that look like they're burnt, quote unquote, on the Giza Plateau. But what I think it is that the Giza Plateau, we actually had a major strike, plasma strike, we can call it, you know, sun lightning strike, actually touching down on the Giza Plateau where it, quote, burnt and vitrified the rock. And going to the ancient inscriptions, there's something known as the Inventory Stela, which actually purports to describe the Sphinx itself being hit by a huge, quote, lightning bolt or thunderbolt and damaging the Sphinx. In incredibly ancient times. In fact, the inscription says that this happened before the time of Khufu, more or less before the time that the Sphinx was even supposed to exist, according to conventional Egyptologists. And Egyptologists have known about this for decades, but they just dismiss it as nonsense and myth. I don't think it needs to be dismissed as nonsense and myth. I think it was a collective memory of that very early period in remote ancient times at the end of the last ice age.
I'm speaking with geologist and professor Dr. Robert Schock. Today's show, Robert Schock and the Solar-Induced Dark Age. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And with regard to Easter Island, what do you think was the purpose of the low, thick stone houses that you write oddly resemble modern bunkers or fallout shelters? I was quite shocked when I saw the color photograph in your book of these houses. They really do look like bunkers.
Oh, I think they do look like sort of bunkers or fallout shelters. And honestly, I think that's effectively what they were, that the best way to describe them in modern times is that that is exactly what they were intended for. This doesn't preclude that they were used for other things, rituals and whatnot. But the point is that it's made for a different purpose. And I suspect that the, quote, stone houses that we're talking about on Easter Island were not necessarily made during the solar outburst, but at least made in case another one occurred, because there was this memory of such things, this concept that we better prepare ahead of time. And yes, they were used later for the Birdman ritual and all that type of thing, and I'm familiar with all that. But that doesn't mean that was their original purpose or that was why they were built initially. Yes, once they're built, you can use them for other things temporarily. But still, revert back to their original use if there's another solar outburst. And I want to point out that on Easter Island, we don't only have those so-called stone houses that sure look like bunkers and fallout shelters, but the island is riddled with natural caves. It's a volcanic island. It has natural lava tube caves. And there is a long tradition of the people on Easter Island living in the caves and using the caves as living quarters, even building up shelves and benches, that type of thing, inside the caves. On one of our trips there, Katie and I were talking to one of the local Easter Islanders. He was actually driving one of the vehicles that we were touring around in, just telling us local legends. He didn't know anything about my interest or my research, and he just happened to mention that, yes, one of the traditions is that for thousands of years they had to live in these caves because things were so bad on the surface. There's also a legend about the sky falling. An Easter Island legend, the sky falling and coming down and then going back up again. I think this all refers to things happening in the sky associated with solar outbursts. When in the 19th century, the Rongo Rongo scripts were first discovered by the Europeans, because the Easter Islands actually hid them until the mid-19th century. Europeans didn't even know that they existed. When they were first asked about them and asked to read them and interpret them, the Easter Islanders at that point really couldn't, quote, read them. But what they indicated is they had something to do with the sky and what had happened in the sky. So I think all the evidence collectively comes back together that they were preparing for, they were aware of what had happened at the end of the last ice age. And at least for a number of generations, innumerable generations, they realized that you should be prepared in case this happened again.
Yes, you write that plasma physicist Anthony Perrott's plasma configurations, petroglyphs, and Rongo Rongo glyphs all depict the same solar electrical phenomena. You have developed the term solar-induced dark age. How long of a period do you think this covered?
Oh, the solar-induced dark age, I can tell you quite specifically, I guess. The solar-induced dark age begins at the end of the last ice age. So you have this huge catastrophe at 9700 BC that wipes out these advanced civilizations, these advanced cultures and societies at that time that were doing things like carving the Great Sphinx or the Proto-Sphinx, the Mehet, the lioness, that were building things like Göbekli Tepe and had all this sophisticated knowledge and technology and techniques. They were thrown into a tailspin. They were devastated by the catastrophes at the end of the last ice age at 9700 BC. So I date the beginning of the solar-induced dark age, or SIDA for short, solar-induced dark age. And it's sort of ironic that the sun would induce a dark age, but that's what happened. So it begins at 9700 BC, and in my assessment, lasts for about 6,000 years, approximately 6,000 years, until civilization reemerges between 4,000 and 3,000 BC. So in round numbers, you could say 9700 BC to maybe 3700 BC is a solar-induced dark age, that 6,000-year period. And what do we see during that 6,000-year period? We see the remnants of societies being much more primitive, being, quote, hunter-gatherers, as people think of it. Yes, they have some agriculture, but they're not doing super well, frankly. It's even acknowledged by conventional archaeologists that lifespans probably went down during that period. People were not as healthy during that period. They were living, in many cases, at a lower technological level. So instead of Göbekli Tepe with megalithic stone structures, What we have is something like Çatalhöyük a couple of thousand years later in Turkey, where you essentially have lots of mud brick houses all stacked against each other, all compacted against each other. It's like the people are huddling together collectively, so to speak, protecting themselves. And that's not just an isolated case. That's what you have consistently during this period of time. You don't have the incredible megalithic structures as you have before the end of the last ice age until the reemergence, what I call the reemergence of sophisticated culture and civilization, which starts to pick up again about 4000 BC and really comes to blossom by, say, in Egypt, 3100 BC with the rise of dynastic Egypt and other parts of the world, maybe a little earlier, maybe in Sumer, in southern Mesopotamia, a bit earlier. People argue about that, but sometime around 3,000 to 4,000 BC. What I'm talking about is a 6,000-year, quote, dark age between the collapse of one cycle of civilization, as I referred to it, at the end of the last ice age, and the reemergence of the next cycle of civilization. So from my perspective, the cycle of civilization that we're in now began a bit over 5,000 years ago and encompasses all of dynastic Egypt and other civilizations at the same time in Mesopotamia, etc., right up to today with our modern technology and electronics, that type of thing. And what is very potentially scary, and I'm not a doomsayer or I want to be a scaremonger, but civilization collapsed at the end of the last ice age, 9700 BC. There was a major solar outburst. The sun has shorter-term and longer-term cycles. One of the longer-term cycles is on about 10-12,000-year cycle. And there's astrophysical evidence that the sun is ramping up again and going into a unstable period as it was at the end of the last ice age. And we could have another major solar outburst, another major solar event. And if it does, we are very, very vulnerable, just like that previous civilization was at the end of the last ice age. In fact, we're probably much, much, much more vulnerable because our electronics and grid system and nuclear power plants and whatnot, it would be absolutely devastated by a solar outburst, our modern technological society.
Yes, and what you're saying is corroborated by electric universe theory, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I've spoken at their conferences. Now, I want to say that electric universe is not a unified group. I mean, there's lots of different branches in it, but they have put a lot of emphasis that we have to look at electrical events in the universe on Earth, that type of thing. And this ties in with solar outbursts, which are essentially electrical geomagnetic effects on Earth, so magnetic electrical effects. And yes, it would definitely tie in with them, and it would tie in with a lot of other work that's being done now on what is sometimes called space weather, the concept that you can have magnetic storms, solar events, even very minor ones, which can disrupt communication satellites, can disrupt power grid systems. We've had this even in modern times that very small solar events can, for instance, bring down parts of grid systems locally. There's a very famous one in Quebec, I want to say 1989 or so, when a lot of millions of people went without power for hours. That was very, very minor. If we had an event the level of the Carrington event in 1859, it would be devastating. In 1859, there was what's known as a solar event. It consisted of a couple of coronal mass ejections, were known as coronal mass ejections, that were spit out by the sun, if you would. Charged particles hit Earth, hit the magnetosphere, and overloaded the electronics of the time. 1859, there wasn't much in the way of electronics. What we had on Earth, what humanity had, was telegraph systems and telegraph lines, but overloaded the telegraph lines. They went crazy. The telegraph system went crazy. It actually overloaded the telegraph lines and burnt down several telegraph stations. It could have electrocuted people, fortunately did not. But it was devastating to the primitive electronics, if you would, at the time. And they were very, very robust compared to what we have now. Now we have really delicate electronics as well as the major grid systems. And if we were hit by an event even half or less as powerful as the 1859 event, it would be devastating to our modern communication systems, our electrical grid, I should say, our electronics. Probably there would be what they call EMP, electromagnetic pulse, associated with it. There was probably one in 1859, but there was no way to detect it. An EMP now would could, in fact, just knock out personal computers and cell phones, that type of thing, independent of any other damage that was caused by the more general outburst. So we've, in some ways, unwittingly, in my opinion, boxed ourselves in and made ourselves really vulnerable to what is a naturally reoccurring event emanating from the sun.
Dr. Robert Schock, thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome. I hate to leave on such a note. But one thing I want to emphasize is that I find ancient civilizations, ancient cultures, inherently fascinating. I think it's just really interesting for many, many people. But also, there are real things to be learned from them. And, you know, these are not just sort of, oh, interesting, isn't it interesting to see how ancient people lived and what the Egyptians built and that type of thing. But there are real lessons we should learn from them, including some things about how we should prepare for the future, because things that happened to these ancient civilizations, those types of natural catastrophes will occur again, and either they survived them or they didn't, but we should learn from it.
I've been speaking with Dr. Robert Schock. Today's show has been Robert Schock and the Solar-Induced Dark Age. Robert Schock is a tenured faculty member at Boston University. He earned his doctorate in geology and geophysics at Yale University. He is the author of Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. And with Robert Boval, Origins of the Sphinx, Celestial Guardian of Pre-Pharaonic Civilization, among many other books. As a member of the Organization for the Research of Ancient Cultures, a nonprofit that raises funds for more research, he co-leads tours to Egypt with his colleague, Egyptian Egyptologist Mohammed Ibrahim. Their next tour will be in June 2019. For more information, please visit robertschock.com. That's Robert, S-C-H-O-C-H.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Which is the evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of light, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call to all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own sight.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, technology whiz Chris Sogoyan discusses the government's secret new techniques for spying on you. I hope you'll stay tuned. After all, they are... Chris Sogoyan is a technology expert and a civil liberties champion with the ACLU. He spoke in Seattle recently on the new technologies that keep your private communication private, and on the government's counterattack with other new technologies for spying on everything you do or say. And it's not just the FBI and the NSA who are eavesdropping. More and more, it's your local police force, too. So, if terms like stingrays and the hacking team are new to you, better listen up. Here is Chris Sogoyan.
So, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you a bit of a history lesson in an attempt to tell you a story about how surveillance has evolved and how law enforcement and intelligence agencies are addressing and coping with changes in technology. For more than 100 years, the telephone companies have provided assistance to law enforcement agents who wanted to monitor the telephone calls of targets in criminal investigations. For 100 years, these companies have provided this assistance. In many cases, there have been dedicated teams of employees at the companies. Today, hundreds of employees at each company are there responding 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to requests from federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies. Really, for a telephone company at this point, surveillance is part of the business. It's not a business they intended to go into, but it's a business they are now in, whether they like it or not. And so for 100 years, law enforcement agencies have known that they could turn to these trusted parties, these partners, the AT&Ts and Verizons of the world, who would give them what they want, and then eventually would even build surveillance features into the very core parts of their network. Our phones today are designed first and foremost to be surveilled. They're designed to deliver calls and text messages as almost an afterthought, but the first feature is the surveillance feature. And so what I want to talk to you about today is sort of how governments have responded to changes in technology, and in particular, how they've responded to first the possibility that people would protect their communications, and then ultimately the availability and use of technologies that would protect people's communications. This is Louis Free. Louis Free was the director of the FBI in the 1990s, and Free was really the first FBI official and first U.S. government official to raise the threat of encryption technology to the public debate. The language that Free used was really a big deal at the time. This is in the mid-1990s, when technology that would allow regular people to protect their communications from surveillance was controlled by law. It was controlled as arms technology, and thus not available for export outside the United States. I'm going to read you some of his quotes. "Uncrackable encryption will allow drug lords, spies, terrorists, and even violent gangs to communicate about their crimes and their conspiracies with impunity." This is this doomsday scenario that Free was describing of a world in which encryption was available to the masses. He added, "The only acceptable answer is socially responsible encryption that permits timely law enforcement and national security access and decryption pursuant to a court order." What Free was talking about was something that technologists and those of us in this space call key escrow. The idea was that a copy of your encryption key, a copy of your encryption password, would be stored by some third party And if you decide, if you did something bad and, or the government decided to take an interest in you, they could go to that third party and get the key and then decipher all your communications. This was the socially responsible cryptography that Free was calling for in 1996. This is actually the chip that implemented this technology. It was called the Clipper chip. And the idea was that there would be one of these chips in every telephone in the country, and all of our communications would be encrypted, which was a good thing, but the encryption could be broken by the government whenever they needed to, in case that someone did something bad. So the Clipper was not a success in the market. It turned out that people didn't want this technology, particularly once researchers showed that the encryption was broken and couldn't just be broken by the government, but could be broken by anyone else. And so towards the end of the 1990s, this system of controls over technology came down. The wall fell down, and suddenly people could export this encryption technology. Suddenly anyone in the world could download free software or buy commercial software that could protect their emails, that could protect their messages, and allow them to communicate in a way that governments could not read or decipher their communications. But PGP, which is one of those tools, it was never a problem for the FBI. It was never a problem for law enforcement. And the reason was is that the encryption tools that were available looked something like this. And in fact, they haven't really changed in their design since then. It turns out that the encryption tools that were available in the 1990s, the encryption tools that the government said everyone could use, were so difficult to use, correctly that no one ever used them. So that brings us to where we are now. Where encryption technology not only is becoming easier to use, but it is now increasingly being built into the products that we all use. So this is the current FBI director, Jim Comey. This is him speaking at a cryptography event in Washington, D.C. Just a few months ago, you can see Comey Crypto, which was the hashtag behind his head. And I'm going to read you a quote of his. Encryption threatens to lead all of us to a very dark place. Sophisticated criminals will come to count on these means of evading detection. It's the equivalent of a closet that cannot be opened, a safe that cannot be cracked. So the rhetoric really hasn't changed in 20 years. The rhetoric is the same. They're still predicting doomsday scenarios, but what's changed is that people are actually using encryption now. So, of course, this is Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple. Apple has been very bold in its marketing in the last year or two. This is from Apple's privacy section of their website. Your iMessages and FaceTime calls are your business, not ours. Your communications are protected by end-to-end encryption across all your devices when you use iMessage and FaceTime. And we wouldn't be able to comply with a wiretap order even if we wanted to. So what this means is that right now, if you have an iPhone or an iPad, and you send text messages or you make a video or audio call with their products to someone else who also has an iPad or an iPhone, those messages are encrypted. And they're encrypted in such a way that if you listen to what Apple says and you believe what Apple says, which I think reasonable people can ask questions about, they're not able to monitor, and thus the government is not able to easily monitor. Now, that's a really big change. That's a sea change from where we were just a few years ago, when if you were making a call with your AT&T or Verizon phone, those companies could and would hand over your telephone communications. They could and would record copies of your text messages and hand them over to government agents at a later date. What's fascinating about what Apple has done isn't that they have made encryption available to users, but that they have turned it on by default. And so even if you don't think about it, you're now using and gaining the protections of this encryption technology. Apple isn't the only player. I don't know how many of you in this room use WhatsApp, but this is an extremely popular service, particularly in the global south and many, many non-US countries. It is basically the de facto text messaging service. And WhatsApp now also uses extremely strong encryption technology, some of the best that's out there. This is the founder of WhatsApp, Jan Koum, saying, quote, I grew up in a society where everything you did was eavesdropped on, recorded, snitched on. Nobody should have the right to eavesdrop or you become a totalitarian state, the kind of state I escaped as a kid to come to this country. Pretty bold statement from a tech company CEO. And again, this is a company whose product is used by hundreds of millions of people. Now, if you don't trust Apple, and you don't trust WhatsApp, which is now owned by Facebook, and you have the ability to convince your friends and loved ones and colleagues to download other software, there's a tool that I really like that's called Signal. It's available in the App Store, and a version of it is also available for Android phones. And using this app, you can make free encrypted telephone calls and send encrypted text messages. Doesn't cost you any money. And this is made by a team of widely respected researchers. There are no hidden backdoors in this service. The problem is your friends and loved ones are probably not using it already, so you have to sort of convince them to download this, whereas with iMessage or WhatsApp, probably people are already using it. And so it's the availability of services like this. It's the fact that suddenly hundreds of millions of people now have access to encryption technology and are now using encryption technology that is causing an epic freakout in law enforcement and national security circles. So I'm speaking in Seattle, Microsoft, hometown employer, going to get asked, so what's the deal with Microsoft's technology, right? We know that Apple and WhatsApp, which is Facebook, are doing this. What about Microsoft? So Microsoft bought Skype. I assume everyone in the audience knows that Skype is a Microsoft service. According to an article that Glenn Greenwald published in 2013, Microsoft has modified their services to make them more amenable to wiretapping by the U.S. government. Quote, Skype was served with a directive to comply by the Attorney General, and after they received that order, they made modifications to the service that allowed the NSA to be able to monitor people's Skype text messages and also Skype audio and video calls. This is Brad Smith, who is Microsoft's general counsel, fairly outspoken guy, has criticized the actions of the U.S. government in forcing Microsoft to hand over data on its Dublin, Ireland-based servers to the U.S. government. This is him in an interview last year. We assume that all calls, whether over the internet or by fixed line or mobile phone, will offer similar levels of privacy and security. So that's Brad Smith saying that the degree of security that Microsoft intends to deliver to customers is the same that you get from your cell phone, which isn't very much. So, you know, if you're deeply concerned about privacy, if you don't want the state to be able to wiretap your communications, I'm afraid that I can't really recommend Skype, but there are plenty of other tools that you can use that will make surveillance much more difficult. All right, so these tools are on your phone today. How are government agencies going to respond? Right, they're not going to just pack up their luggage and go home. They want to be able to wiretap the communications of interesting individuals, individuals who they believe are doing things that are bad. How will they respond? So in 2012, I started researching the question of hacking by governments. There have been a number of stories showing that governments around the world were buying off-the-shelf hacking software, that governments in Ethiopia and Vietnam and other places were buying commercial surveillance technology that they could use to hack into people's computers and take over their webcams and microphones and that kind of thing. And I thought, well, hang on, the FBI has a lot of money. They're probably doing it too, right? So I stumbled on this document that another civil liberties group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, had been able to get from the government through FOIA. And as you can see, most of it's redacted, but there was this one line on the document, this remote operations unit that I saw, and I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And so I started Google stalking the remote operations unit at the FBI to see what I could find out. And I looked at the LinkedIn pages of contractors who'd worked there. I found that the unit chief of the ROU in his university fraternity alumni magazine described what he did at his day job. And so I was eventually able to take all this information and give it to the Wall Street Journal, and they were able to confirm that the FBI has a dedicated team of agents in Quantico, Virginia, and all they do every day is hack into people's computers. They have the ability to activate microphones and webcams. The most fascinating thing is the light next to your webcam isn't controlled by hardware. So they can turn the camera on without the light also going on. The light is sort of for your benefit, but not if the FBI is in your computer. And so this team has existed, it turns out, in one form or another, since 2002. And it wasn't until last year that the FBI finally started to be at least a little bit open about their use of this technology. They went to this obscure body in Washington, D.C., a body run by the courts, and they said, we have this problem that right now we need to go to a judge in the district where the crime is happening to get a court order, and if we don't know where the bad guy is, we don't know which judge to go to. So we want permission to get a judge in any part of the country to authorize hacking in any other part of the country. So that was our opportunity, the first time ever for anyone in the civil liberties community to say, hang on a second, maybe we should have a conversation about hacking before we give the FBI these powers. So the problem is they have this surveillance software. They need to get it onto your computer somehow. They have to trick you into downloading it or hack into your browser or something. And so it turns out that trickery is a pretty common method that they use. That was the big news last November. It's odd for me to come here to Seattle where this, you know, in the region where this thing actually happened. And again, this wasn't like the biggest terrorism threat in the world. This was a student calling it a bomb threat because he or she didn't want to take their exam on time. This is a really powerful surveillance tool being used in that case. So the FBI has a lot of money. And when agencies have lots of money, they buy really powerful tools. But not all agencies have the same resources and the same tools. And so what we find is that other law enforcement agencies that have the same needs but don't have the same budgets have to get lesser quality, cut-price tools. And luckily, there is a thriving industry of commercial surveillance companies who are quite happy to sell sophisticated surveillance technology to law enforcement agencies around the world. So one of these companies is called Hacking Team. Their product is called DaVinci. This is from some of their marketing materials. Defeat encryption, total control over your targets, thousands of encrypted communications per day, get them. I mean, the marketing is not shy. They say that they can get encrypted voice, location, web browsing, the works. So I've been tracking this company for several years. Their software has shown up on the computers of activists and reporters in Morocco, in Ethiopia, in Vietnam, I mean, in use by some governments that really have no respect for human rights. This company doesn't care about who they sell to. And so I've seen that for the last few years, they've been coming to Washington, D.C., and have been speaking at and exhibiting at this surveillance industry trade show where law enforcement agencies show up and see like what the cool tools are that year. And I actually went to this conference. I snuck in 2012, and I put on a suit. And I don't know how many of you have been to Washington, D.C., but the uniform in Washington, D.C. is ugly, ill-fitting suits. And so I bought this like cheap suit from the thrift store, and I put it on, and I went to the conference, and I snuck in, and I secretly recorded what I saw. And this company was there, and they were giving out their flyers and the mints and the fridge magnets. And so I learned about them there. It turns out they don't just go to that conference. They actually go to the Association of Law Enforcement Intelligence Units annual conference. This is larger police departments have dedicated teams that just do surveillance. And this is the annual U.S. conference for these law enforcement agencies' surveillance teams. So I've been hunting down Hacking Team for a while, because I'm convinced that they've sold their stuff in the United States. They have an office in Washington, D.C., and I think it's only a matter of time before their stuff is used by state and local agencies. So the problem with this technology, and not just the hacking software, but in fact many kinds of surveillance technology, is that it's expensive. I mean, not like millions and millions of dollars, but like $200,000, $300,000. That's too much money for a local law enforcement agency. They have stretched budgets, particularly in these current economic times. They don't have the money for these cool toys, or cool tools, rather. And so luckily, there are nice bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. who are happy to give grant money to local law enforcement agencies. And so where you've seen surveillance technologies spreading into your community, here in Washington State, in Tacoma, where they purchased Stingray technology, it was with grants from DHS. So you guys got a mesh network web camera thing here in Seattle, money from Washington, D.C. If there have been surveillance cameras in your streets, money from Washington, D.C. Where it's been drones or armored personnel carriers, money from Washington, D.C. Bearcats, the armored personnel carriers that I think many people saw in the wake of Ferguson, money from DHS, money from DOJ, and surplus from DOD. Drones making their way into small town communities, money from Washington, D.C. And this thing, the tool that I've been hunting for 4 years, the Stingray, this is a tool that allows law enforcement agents to track and identify every cell phone in an area, money from Washington, D.C. So what's fascinating about the Stingray, and I guess similarly to the hacking stuff and the drones and these other things, these were tools that were designed for the military and for the intelligence community. And the problem is that the Raytheons and the Booz Allens and the Boeings that sell this technology, they can only sell so much to the military. Eventually, they've saturated that market. And so they're looking for additional markets, and while law enforcement is a happy market, these tools make law enforcement's job easier. So the tools sell themselves. The only question is, well, how do we pay for them? And that's where Washington, D.C. comes in. They write blank checks to pay for the gear. So, you know, I think reasonable people can have a debate about whether these technologies are appropriate in Iraq or Afghanistan or Yemen, and I'm sure that my views maybe aren't in line with everyone's, but I think many of us should be able to agree that technologies that are designed for use in a hostile war zone may not necessarily be appropriate for Main Street back here in the United States. And the Stingray is an example of this. This is a technology that sends signals into people's living rooms. This is not a surgical technology that tracks one phone. This is a technology that sends signals into every house in a neighborhood, identifies every phone that's nearby, creates a list of every phone that's nearby, and then provides that to the agent that's using the device. This is a technology that was built for the intelligence services. Just this week, the Wall Street Journal had a story talking about the relationship between the CIA and the marshals. The marshals put these things on airplanes and fly them over cities, and it described the relationship between the CIA technology unit and the marshals technology unit as a marriage. That's how close they are, presumably a happy marriage, not an unhappy one. But this is a technology that is now trickling down to state and local law enforcement agencies around the country, and we know that they're in use here in Washington State. These are technologies that have been put into use in your community without any debate. Because the money came from Washington, they didn't have to go to the city council and have a thorough debate about how these technologies were going to be used. They didn't have to explain how they would work. They wouldn't have to explain the collateral damage or the fact that they would collect information about innocent people who've done nothing wrong. They go to the city council and they say, hey, we got this grant from FEMA or from DOJ. Can we accept the money? You know, this will help law enforcement, this will keep us safe. And of course, the city councils always say yes, because who's going to turn down free money, free training, free tools? So these tools are put into our communities without any oversight from our city councils, from our state legislative bodies, or even in Congress. There have been no hearings at the federal level, and there have only been hearings on stingrays in the last year in Michigan and Texas and here in Washington State. These are technologies that are put into use in communities without any debate, and it's not like that's an oversight, that's the purpose. The argument that law enforcement agents use is that they have to put this technology into use secretly, because if they told the public how it worked, it would tip off the bad guys. We see these quotes time and time again from local police chiefs saying, look, you know, we're using this in the right way, we're using it in an appropriate way, but we can't tell you anything more, you have to trust us. Because if we told people how it worked, the bad guys would figure out how to avoid it. Right? And that's this conflict in the area of surveillance. They don't want to tell us how it works because someone in this room is going to commit a crime, so the rest of us have to be kept in the dark so that one person doesn't know how it works. So, and then in addition to not having any debate, means we also don't have any oversight. Legislative bodies don't know, and more importantly, the courts don't know. So here in Washington State, the courts have been kept in the dark. Around the country, courts have been kept in the dark. To the extent that law enforcement agencies get court orders for this, the applications for the court orders don't say what they're planning on doing. But because of this transparency that's coming from local media, because of organizations like the ACLU that have been forcing this stuff into the sunlight, it's starting to change. And so in Tacoma, we're now seeing that judges have instituted a new protocol. They now demand that the police change the way they get permission for this technology. Judges demand information from the police. And all it took was a few front page stories. So, as I said, we've now had hearings in, I think, three or four states about stingrays. There are several states where legislation has been introduced. In Virginia, where I live, there's a bill sitting on the governor's desk that would require a warrant for stingrays. I know here in Washington, your state house has passed a bill, and there'll be a hearing tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. for the Senate to look at that legislation, and then hopefully it will reach the governor's desk. In Utah, they require a warrant for all cell tracking. So bit by bit, we're getting some oversight over these invasive cell phone tracking technologies. But what we're not getting just yet is similar oversight and action from legislative bodies about hacking technology. I think one of the reasons for that is that right now we only know that federal agencies are using it. We haven't caught any state or local law enforcement agencies using it. I'm sure they're using it, right? Hacking team has an office in Maryland. They're sending their salespeople out. They're buying coffee at conferences. I'm sure that someone's bought this stuff. But until we catch them red-handed, until we get a front-page story in a small-town paper, we're not going to get reform. But this technology is so invasive. The idea that the police can turn on your webcam and your microphone without your knowledge and listen to what's happening in your bedroom or in your office or, you know, in your psychiatrist's office, this is terrifying, the capability, and there's been absolutely no oversight. And so we need to get oversight over this technology, over the use of these tools. We need to make sure that our state legislative bodies and ultimately that Congress takes a close look at this. But it all starts here in small communities and even big cities like Seattle. It all starts with your local ACLU affiliate. It all starts with your local press who are hounding police and getting questions from judges and finding out what your law enforcement agencies are doing. Thank you for your time.
Chris Segoyan with Words for Our Time, speaking in Seattle on March 11, 2016. Our thanks to Seattle's own Mike McCormick for the original audio recording, which I have condensed just a tad. And thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust saying, keep the Aspidistra flying, write if you get work. Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. And illegitimi non-carborundum, one and all. Peace. Thank you.
This is CIT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and we have a special guest, Mike Hirsch, a steelworker activist. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing good.
Yeah. Hey, now, we, of course, wondered what happened to the big parade. Every year, they go from somewhere on Queen Street to the gates of the CNE, and then they go in. But this year, they didn't go, right?
They didn't go. We stopped at Lamport Stadium on King Street because of the strike. It's not a strike. It's a lockout of IATSE Local 58. And they've been locked out since, I think, 5 or 6 weeks. They led the parade.
They put them in front.
They put them in front.
I like that.
Which is nice, good. Actually. And then everybody, when they went into the stadium, had to go through them to get in, so we could all cheer for them and they could cheer for us. And it was a nice feeling.
So they were opening. That's not symbolic. Somebody gave it a little thought.
Yeah, they did. And actually, it was probably – it made the event more political, ending in Lamport Stadium rather – than the CNE, because of the CNE, I mean, I've been going to these for 50 years, mm-hmm. since 1969, and the format's always been the same. Yeah. You go into the stadium, and then you disperse, and the buses take you to wherever the affiliate is having an event. There's no speeches. There's nothing.
Yeah.
And I heard – I wasn't there because the steelworkers went back to the Cecil mm-hmm. Street. Went back to Cecil Street.
There you go.
And So,
Mike
but
is
I heard
a singer, by the way. We shouldn't have to tell him how close you get to a mic.
I know. Well, you know, okay.
But when you're talking to Mike about a mic, you get into this problem. Go ahead.
So I hear there were speeches this time at Lamport Stadium. I wasn't there because we went back to Cecil Street.
Went back to Cecil Street.
The steelworkers had a barbecue there. But it's – like I say, I've been going to these in the 50 years since I've been a steelworker. I've only missed three of these things.
Wow.
The format hasn't changed in all that time, actually. It's
changing now.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you. For me personally, I used to like Labor Day because we used to get – from my plant, John Inglis, we used to get 30 or 40 people just from my plant.
Yes.
And then we'd march up Queen Street. And in those days, most of the people who worked at Inglis lived in that neighborhood. So there would always be Inglis people and their families, and they'd be cheering the Inglis people on. And then you get to Dufferin Street, and Maisie Tiller on the fourth floor of her apartment would throw down water for all of us, all the steelworkers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a nice event. We all felt pretty good about it.
That trailed off.
Well, I don't think there were more.
The plant is gone and the neighborhood
there were,
is gone.
There were only about a little over 100
Other
steelworkers.
Other than that, everything's fine.
There was only about 100 steelworkers, maybe a few more. But it wasn't as big. And even – I mean, it was a hot day.
Yeah.
And because we didn't go to the CNE, I assume that maybe that, you know, made it that people didn't want to march. Because people want to go into the CNE for free. That's why they – this is what it's become.
You know, the whole concept – seems so crummy. In other words, we're going to do – it's the Prince's Gate. This is your little favor. Thank you for working all year. Go in and spend some money. Have a good time. We let you in free. It's just so crummy. On another program, I compared it to the – when you were unorganized workers, a lot of plants I was in. Thanksgiving, they gave you a turkey. And, and you all stood there with your turkey. Everybody said, see? We love you. And you say, no.
It's I was listening to Sid Ryan on your show. Was it last week?
Yeah.
And he was talking about politicizing it, Labor Day. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's a good idea. You could end – instead of ending it at the CNE and you want to show support for IATSE, you could either do it at Queen's Park or IATSE has been put on strike by the Board of Governors and of the CNE, and that's municipal politics. John Tory has the chair has made appointed as chair of the board. This guy Mark Grimes, who's anti-union to the core, because the board consists of some progressives too. Mike Layton's on it, and others, and so he's been trying to get negotiations going. And this guy Grimes, who used to be the counselor in Ward 6 in Etobicoke. He was on the TTC board, and and fought against Moscow because he was Howard Moscow at the time because he was trying to negotiate with ATU. And he quit because he thought that Moscow was soft on the union. This guy's an anti-union guy. And he's the one that's leading the charge against IATSE. So you could actually end the demonstration in front of the Tory's office or Mark Grimes' office. Well, there's a lot of political things you could do with this.
Well, Sid underlined that we used to have legislation against replacement workers / scabs, anti-scab legislation, and we lost that. And so the demand is clearly now this shows why we that was a terrible loss, and they have to replace it because here you have a showcase moment for Ontario, and what they're showcasing is union busting. And so, they should be getting back on. He also said on the show he thought we should have it on May Day. He said, like all the rest of the world, we're not in step with the organized labor of the rest of the world.
You know, I did a little research last night on this because I knew I was going to be sitting here.
Yeah, you're going to be on a hot seat.
And so actually there was an opportunity to make Labor Day in Canada in May. The original Labor Day was April 15th. And it was over militant action. It was over the fighting for the 9-hour day, and it was for over 20 years. It was April 15th, and the original one was because 24 members of the Typographical Union had been imprisoned for having a demonstration, and so. The demonstration was in support of the imprisoned members of Typographical Union. Yeah. So, I mean, it was an easy move to have it from April 15th to May 1st if they wanted to do that. But the Americans changed it in 1894 to September. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the history of that or why
that
it happened.
Well, that was a political struggle to get it away from the initiative of labor itself and turn it into, a kind of a quasi-official thing so that they could control it. It would be the short
that would be
analysis of that.
Yeah.
At least they didn't go in this year, and that's I think we have to credit it.
Yeah.
It is a union. Phil was saying earlier, the union movement has some problems. It needs to get to work on. Unifor was not part of your
Unifor marched down university to. To boats and took a cruise, I guess.
They're cruising, yes.
But somehow the CBC put the name of the Unifor president in their article about the rally today with no other union.
He wasn't there. Unifor was not there.
Well, not according to the CBC.
I mean, so, I was there.
Yeah.
So Unifor wasn't.
The plan to divide, destroy the union movement is moves on apace.
Absolutely.
Because, it's the character in one of these movies said it must have happened. I read it in a paper. Yeah. So the paper will tell you, is there a labor movement? Then they will say, yeah, this one. And then they will interview the guy and say, we reported on it. You say, yeah, but he wasn't elected. Or this happens to be the one that now says it doesn't want to be in the Canadian Labor Congress. And so
this Labor Day is an event of a subordinate body of the Canadian Labor Congress. Yeah. I mean, the Metro Labor Council is part of the Labor Congress setup.
It is a crisis. Yeah. It needs to be addressed. Mike, I know you have some news for us. We're all trying to understand how things are going to unfold in Mexico. There's been a leader there. His name is Obrador. He's been elected.
Yeah.
There's a number of issues. The reason we need to ask you a couple questions about it, I know you have some things we want you to share. Obrador, by reputation, is a friend of Cuba. He's a friend of Maduro. He is he's his own style of politician, but he's not in the American camp on regime change. Let's put it that way. Due to the way they conduct their constitutional procedures, he's been elected for quite a while already, but he doesn't take office until December. Now, they rush through, as Chrystia Freeland would tell you, since she has tire marks across her midsection, the agreement with Mexico. on this whatever it was, non-free trade or free trade non. We don't really know whether Obrador – I know he had a representative, but you can see our problem. He's got the job, but, you know, he's got to be careful because the government's still in the hands of the other guy.
That's right.
And the other guy is the one who did the deal. Now, they say Obrador's people were present, but you'd have to wonder, are they full-throated or are they watching, or, you know? And – but – you have seen a sign, or you've heard about one, that we used to talk about on this show, a major Mexican labor leader. Been given something, a new role. Tell us about him.
Well, I took Kenny Newman as the national director of the steelworkers, and I took him from Lamport Stadium to Cecil Street, and I asked him about what was going on. He just came back last night from Mexico. Let me start with the fact that when Napoleon Gomez was selected.
Note the name, folks.
Napoleon.
Yes, Napoleon.
There was a march of 5,000 mostly miners who marched with him to his inauguration. Now, that's impressive. Mm. And Ken Newman thought that was pretty impressive. Uh-huh. And so that's a good sign of what kind of leader he was and is.
Where has he been? He was in a lot of trouble.
He was in a lot of trouble because Grupo Mexico, all the billionaires that own the mining down there, hate his guts because he didn't negotiate collective bargaining the way traditional leaders, union leaders, negotiate. Unfortunately, a lot of the traditional union leaders in Mexico, they make a deal that mostly highlights their self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
I got a quote from Obrador on that, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, please.
I have to find it here.
I'll play the piano in the background.
He said, "It's an injustice that the towns where companies extract gold are where we have more poverty and abandonment." And it was because there's more poverty in these miners, mainly because traditionally the leaders of the union was not fighting in their interests.
Yes.
Napoleon did not play that game. He when he negotiated, he wanted safety. He wanted benefits and wages.
What happened to him?
Well, what happened?
Did you meet him? He was here. Did you meet him?
Oh, no, he and I are friends. We're friends on Facebook, and I socialize with
him.
Thanks
for sharing that. Yeah,
these I'm
guys
sorry.
Are, I mean, you know, modesty. You knew Marilyn? We're on Facebook.
He and I are friends on Facebook, and I just wished him a happy birthday last week. He's 70. Well, 4 years old.
Did he? Wow. So okay. Now
he's
you met him here.
He was at in Vancouver because he was based in Vancouver the last few years. When Obama won, I was in Kenny Newman's hospitality suite, and it was Ken Newman and Kathy, his wife, and it was Napoleon and his wife, and Felicia and I. And so that's who was at and. I mean,
and he's a wanted man.
He's a wanted
in Mexico.
Man. Well, you know,
he was.
Now
he's
his
really
story
wanted.
Is interesting because I asked Ken about it. The billionaires, Grupo Mexico, wanted him arrested, and the cops went to his house, and they were supportive of him, and they said, "Look, we were told to arrest you. We'll come up with charges later." That's what they told him. And so you got 6 hours to get out of here. I think it's all right for me to tell this story.
Well, that's part of the record, isn't it?
I think it is on the record.
No secret that he was a wanted man. I first heard of him because the Canadian Labor Congress and steelworkers had taken up his cause. And we knew he was here. He was, not shipped, as sometimes happens.
Yeah.
But he's a very important story. And it's amazing now, just to sort of freeze the point, he's named a senator. He got a role now. He's going to be.
He's now senator.
He's been named.
He's been named a senator in,
by Obrador.
By Obrador.
So Obrador is indicating that's what he's going to do. I assume all this will be.
It's to raise income for working class people. It's to investigate mines, the use of explosives because it's unsafe. It's to share the wealth. Yeah. No wonder Grupo México doesn't like him. You're going to take their money.
Well, you're talking about Obrador.
Obrador. Yeah. And that's also what Napoleon stands for as well.
Yeah.
And so then you can. So what they did is they put laid some trumped up charges of embezzlement, mm-hmm. of $55 million, mm-hmm. that they said that he absconded with, mm-hmm. and it was later dropped because there was nothing.
Yeah.
And I used to make fun of him. I used to say, if you've got $55
million, how come I'm paying for dinner?
How come Ken Newman's paying for all the beer?
Yeah.
You know, it was trumped up charges. And
it's interesting about smear jobs. Once somebody gets smeared, it's you can't undo a smear. I mean, people will repeat that, even though, as you point out, no evidence was ever brought. And in fact, now, of course, he's being recognized for what he was and is, a labor leader.
Yeah,
so they have a Senate, and he's going to be in that.
He's going to be in the Senate. He had 5,000 miners marching with him to his inauguration, which is impressive.
This is the inauguration of Obrador.
Because Obrador's not taken over until December.
I thought I was mishearing.
I'm sorry. I'm going back. Yeah, this is back to Napoleon.
Yeah.
So, anyways, Napoleon.
What inauguration? What is it we're describing?
To Napoleon's inauguration.
Okay.
Yeah. But to be in the Senate. He is in the Senate.
Okay.
Obrador is not leading the
and
government.
The miners came to go to
– He was – the government – The government tried to throw him out as president 5 times. He was reelected 5 times.
Yeah.
He used to have meetings with his staff every day from the national office at first on the 7th floor, because I work on the 7th floor.
Yeah.
And he would Skype meetings. And when he spoke at his Congress, he would stand up, even though he's not there. But it was like he was
well,
there.
Well, that's the appropriate thing.
He's standing up and he's speaking and he's looking out on the Skype to all the miners.
He can see them.
And he can see them and they can see him and he's standing up.
Well, that's appropriate.
I thought it was. He's an interesting character, actually.
The former government thought he was so interesting. They didn't want him. They were going to put him in prison.
But what happened, you got to give credit to the International Union of Steelworkers and National Office, particularly Ken Newman, because they literally smuggled him out. Those 6 hours he had to leave, he went to Albuquerque, not far from your brother's place, actually.
Yeah.
And then Leo Girard arranged his entry into Canada. Wow. The National Office, Ken Newman, arranged that he become a citizen. So that was all done. He was in Toronto for a while, moved to Vancouver.
Yeah.
And by the way, when he was away for the 12 years, he was exiled for 12 years, nobody sat in his chair the whole 12 years in his office in Mexico. Nobody sat in his chair. He was still considered all those years, even though he was exiled. He was president of that local, and he still is. He can be a president and still be in the Senate. He's still president of the union.
So he can serve as president. And he will be in the Senate.
Yeah,
That's terrific. That is. By the way, I mean, we were just talking about what is ailing, the labor movement, how it needs maybe a little salt and pepper. See, that kind of thing, that's important symbolic part of the fight. So if they say, well, he's not your president, you say, that's his chair,
and
nobody's
going
to sit in it except him. You understand me?
Yeah.
This is making it into – so everybody remembers. We come in the room, see the empty chair there? That's for the chairman. I like that. It just shows you have a healthier environment. It seems to me that steelworkers ought to send Leo Girard or your national director – to Obrador's inauguration, because he obviously is the one who did the right thing, right? I mean, somebody really began to pull on the levers and brakes and whatever to say Obrador's coming is going to be different.
Yeah,
And so they can call – I love this language. Call Napoleon. Tell him we need him. Tell him the chair is open. The Mexico had a lot with, you know, French and Napoleon. And then, of course, who was the one they shot? The emperor.
Maximilian.
Maximilian.
Yeah.
Who had been put there by the French. So the involvement of Mexico with the French Revolution and the concept and all, it's imprinted on them. As George Bernard Shaw said, we were denied that opportunity. He said, it's unfortunately. So you must have a pretty good impression then that we're pretty clearly saying the Obrador is a real deal.
It sounds like he's good.
You always, his guys come in and you say you have such hopes, right?
His party, what's it called, Morena Party. By the way, that's the other thing Napoleon did is he took his union out of the right wing parties and put them in an organization called the PRD, Democratic Renewal Party. It's sort of an NDP type party, and then the Morena Party was a sort of a new NDP, and that's the one that Obrador is leading. But it sounds like there's not much of a political difference. Obviously, if he chose Napoleon to be in the Senate as an ally, then there can't be a big difference between both parties. But I think they're in different parties.
It does appear that the old ruling party is breaking up. It's a Party of Revolutionary Institutions. It's called the PRI, right?
Yeah.
And in the past, they had breakoffs, including the son of their greatest modern president, Cardenas. And Cardenas is the one who nationalized the oil, all U.S. oil companies, basically. And there was almost war with Mexico over that. The U.S. has got very threatening. But Cardenas became a national hero. So his son was before Obrador, it looked like the son was going to be able to mount a challenge to the PRI. But they outmaneuvered whatever. But people in Mexico kept coming back. And, you know, this Obrador, of course, was the president of the place they call Mexico, Mexico City. And he really... I suppose he had the advantage over Cardenas Jr., I'm going to call him, in that he had served. People had seen him. He actually had the job. He did the job. And so ordinary people knew him, and they could associate activity, good, positive things for the city of Mexico by saying, he was our mayor. We know him. And so I suppose that gave him that kind of gravitas that you need if you're going to take on the PRI. When the election happened, I was afraid he would win the presidency, but the party would be, you know, the Congress would belong to others. But my understanding is the Congress is his Congress.
I think so. Yeah.
So now we have President Trump, and then we're going to have President Obrador, and we are in for a rodeo. That's a real deal. It's going to be quite a contest. I suppose everybody's just going to hold their breath until December when the things will start to go. Because, you know, the U.S. has a major campaign to remove Maduro. And I can tell it's a major campaign because the NDP's joined it. That's, you know, they think it's great. And the Green Party, they think it's wonderful. And the Liberals, it's gorgeous and beautiful and wonderful. And, of course, the Tories think it's wonderful. So, you know, Maduro has to go, I think it's the... position. But Mr. Obrador is going to say, no. And, you know, not far away is Honduras, you know. And Honduras, they elected a guy in a cowboy hat who was not a bad guy. And Hillary Clinton had him overthrown, you remember? And they shot a bunch of people, as they have to do. And they got rid of the cowboy hat liberal. But the people are very unhappy. And they are making a comeback. So they will have a friend in Mr. Obrador. And as you know, too, the CIA has been very busy now deciding they're going to remove the government of Nicaragua and all the appropriate people, every NGO you ever put any money into went down and denounced what's his name, the president?
Ortega.
Daniel. Is he Daniel? Okay. Yeah. Daniel Ortega, they said. And they really tried to, you know, one of those color revolutions or smell revolutions or whatever it is. And they said, you know, you can smell the fresh coming in. And then started shooting policemen and kidnapping trade union. But it's been apparently Ortega has fought them off. But it tells you that they've gone back to the old ways of, you know, knocking people over. But at the same time, there seems to be more pushback coming. You were going to say something, Phil? No.
The only thing about Napoleon, I asked Ken about it because I'm worried about it. This is Mexico. Mm-hmm. And they assassinate people in Mexico if you're not – you know, because these guys, Grupo Mexico, they're billionaires, multi-billionaires. And they can pay off people to assassinate people. And I said, is this guy protected? I mean, he's back in Mexico, and he may be in the Senate, but that doesn't stop anybody from shooting him.
Well, the danger, of course, you put your finger on a problem, but you can tell this is all these guys are in that environment. You know, during the during the last election in Mexico, and I don't want to say a number, but it was a big number of people who were candidates who were shot. They seemed to understand this is what we do. You know, like until this question gets worked out over what type of leadership is going to be, we're going to experience that. But you can anticipate a man who was almost arrested, who was had to flee for his life, has asked himself that, and those people who arranged for him to have an empty chair in his place, they thought about it. So
he does have some. Apparently, he's got security that Obrador has given him, but he also has miners too. He's got his own union.
They all have to. This is we're back in the time of what Norman Mailer calls the wet jobs. You know, Mailer wrote a book about CIA. Mailer should not have been a novelist. Should have just written political books, but he. He said they do wet jobs, which means knock them off. But again, well, we're in a new. We have none of us ever been here before. As somebody likes to say, this is a new situation. Maybe I should say. I want to say, if you don't
we
mind
have
me.
A guest in the outside of the.
We what?
We have a guest outside, Tony.
Yeah, but he's just an admirer. That's a fan. Yeah, that's – no. He'll be on a show in the future when we're on television. I have to just segue, if you don't mind. By the way, we thank Mike very much for being here. What a story you bring us. It turns out I wanted to find out, you know, a few details about Napoleon. It turns out you know him. So we're going to – that means – we're going to demand you come back, and we like to follow. If he's the miners' leader, we're going to want to follow you. You following him, you know, because and you raise a point. Maybe I won't go to the segue. We'll just talk about this. people work in gold; turned out they're poor, right?
Yeah.
People work in diamonds; they're poor. And the coltan is being extracted so that you can have a mobile phone in Eastern Congo. Is mined by people who have no money. Their lives are horrible. And anywhere where there's precious metals, your work includes the daily humiliation of a body exam. I mean, they don't play. So it's very important you remain poor and that you're knee-deep in muck, et cetera. But thank goodness there are people like Napoleon who organize people so that they can get a living wage.
I should also say, you know, I forgot an important story there because
we could use one.
65 miners died in 2006 in a disaster, and there was a methane explosion. This is what, in fact, this was the event that led Grupo Mexico to go after him because he called Grupo Mexico. He called it industrial genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And he went after the billionaires, and that's when they turned
out. So that was when they said
that was the event
no mas, as they say.
Yeah, no mas.
Yeah, there's certain he broke the little sound barrier when he because that means that some of them might get arrested, which it will be interesting to see if that's the way Obrador plays with people who, you know, who run enterprises that cause the deaths of workers and whatnot. That's always one of the marks of an actual socialist government, which I believe Mr. Obrador says that's what he intends to have. It is going to be exciting.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Confirming Kavanaugh would tip the scales of justice against working people.
Liar, liar, pants on fire. See you squirm, see you perspire. Not a word you say is true. There's never been one out of you. Smoke and mirrors, bait and switch. You and your friends are getting rich. Picking pockets, pulling strings, and other more despicable things. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Preaching only to the choir. Photo op in front of the steeple. How did you manage to fool these people? You talk the lingo, dress the part, even put your hand over your heart. Bomber jacket, emperor's clothes, you can't even reach the end of your nose.
Liar, liar, pants on fire. We're going to have a lot of cause to continue to use that song over the months to come. The AFL-CIO's president, Richard Trumka, described Trump's nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. For Brett Kavanaugh, his second pick to the Supreme Court, as having a dangerous track record protecting the privileges of the wealthy and powerful at the expense of working people.
The Service Employees International Union, one of the country's largest, just tweeted that confirming Kavanaugh would tip the scales of justice against working people. To ready us for the battle at hand, Sharon Block, executive director of Harvard's Labor and Work-Life Program, makes the case that Kavanaugh's record reflects a sustained and at times aggressive hostility to the role of law in protecting the vulnerable and the less powerful.
Sharon Block, prepare us to repel the second of Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court. After all, know thine enemy.
You know, I think if you look at Judge Kavanaugh's record, and he does have an extensive record, he's been on the D.C. Circuit, which is considered, you know, the second highest court in the land for 12 years. And, you know, I think it is fair to say, if you look at his record, he has a strong propensity to rule on the side of corporations against the interests of workers, and to do it in a way that really pushes the envelope of the cases that come before him. And you know, to be honest, that's what makes me the most concerned about the prospect of him being confirmed.
Well, why don't we start with some of the cases that you think are most important that Kavanaugh has ruled on, so we know who this guy is. I mean, there was one case that dealt with immigrant workers. I think it was the agri-processes case, which put some questions his feelings about the immigrant workforce to be given labor protections.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of reasons to be really concerned about the position that he took in agriprocessors. So first, there's just the merits of the case itself, whether people who are workers who are undocumented should be protected by our nation's labor standards and other statutes that are designed to make the workplace fair, to make it safe. And so I think just on the merits of that, I find it very troubling that he was that he wanted to write all of these people out of those really important fundamental protections, both for, in the case of the National Labor Relations Act, which was what was at issue. It also has, to write a whole category of people out of the protections of the act. It's obviously devastating for them. It's also terrible for the people that they work with, the documented workers that they work with. So it's just that in and of itself I found to be a very troubling decision. But I think even more troubling is the fact that for the most people believe that the Supreme Court has decided this issue twice, actually. And yet Judge Kavanaugh still, wrote this dissent saying, no, that's not true. So I think it's troubling in assessing his record on how he feels about protecting the rights of workers, especially vulnerable workers like undocumented workers. But I think it's also troubling for those of us who care about a number of issues where Kavanaugh is perceived as the swing vote, about how he thinks about precedent. And so the fact that he was willing to take this position that was really out of step with the way that most people read Supreme Court precedent is really troubling. So, I think for people who care about the continuing viability of Roe versus Wade, the fact that he says, has made supposedly some statements in meetings with senators that it's settled law, that seems to mean something a little bit different for him, at least if you look at the position he took in the agriprocessor case.
We can and we should go through a number of his major decisions, SeaWorld and so on. But what I also want to get to is where the Trump administration and its cronies are at now, and where the corporatocracy is, that there is really an ideological sway to put property rights before democratic rights, and whatever rights stem from property rights, not the other way around. And so I want to get a handle politically on what you think the aggregate of the decisions of Brett Kavanaugh are relevant to the considerations for working people, for democratic rights versus the prevalence of the almighty dollar of property rights as the core, as the raison d'etre of this society, ideologically.
Right. Now, I think if you use his decisions in cases about working people, about labor, as a lens to look at how he sees sort of the power structures in our country, I think it paints a pretty clear picture that he is very sympathetic to the concerns of corporate America and has a basic misunderstanding of what it's like to be a working person in this economy. And so you get this consistent misreading of how are the laws that are supposed to protect workers work, and then siding with those corporate interests. And you brought up briefly the SeaWorld case, and I think the SeaWorld case is an excellent example of how he sees the world through with this sympathy for the corporate interest and a misunderstanding of how the power structure works in terms of how workers come into those relationships. He essentially says, well, why isn't it, he refers to the Occupational Safety and Health Act and the way that OSHA had interpreted in that case as paternalistic. Like, why should the law protect workers? Why can't they just make their own decisions? And why can't they just, operate in the economy without the law sort of butting in? To me, that just reflects a really fundamental misunderstanding of what most work relationships between employers and employees are like. And, you know, workers today don't have the power to stand up and say, I'm not going to work here unless you assure me that this is a safe workplace. That's why we pass statutes like the Occupational Safety and Health Act to put the government on the side of holding companies, corporations accountable for providing safe workplaces, because workers just don't have the power to do that on their own. And, you know, the Occupational Safety and Health Act was passed in the 1970s when union density and a lot more workers actually had a union behind them to sort of to try to navigate those relationships. In today's America, where we've got so many fewer people represented by unions, workers are even less able to negotiate on their own behalf for basic protections. So, you know, I think that's a theme that you see throughout Kavanaugh's decisions. It's just this misunderstanding of sort of how power is allocated within our economy and our society.
And we just want to mention that the SeaWorld Florida case versus Perez involved the death of a worker who trained, quote-unquote, killer whales who performed for the public at the theme park. And one of the whales dragged the train under the water, drowning her. So how do you look at the issue of that kind of case and the reality that we already have a Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, the first nominee of Donald Trump, and we have a John Roberts, also very friendly to property and business. So how important is it, and what else do we know of Kavanaugh at this point, when you are juxtaposing that with the what really seems like it would be a full court press for property rights on the Supreme Court?
No, I'm very glad you asked that. I think especially in relation to labor cases, as to what we could expect from this new court were Kavanaugh to be confirmed, I think we're going to see more court sessions like we had this year, which was a terrible, terrible session for workers between the Epic Systems case, which essentially made mandatory arbitration and class action waivers, you know, that they just gave wholesale approval to employers across the country imposing those kinds of limitations on workers. And then, of course, the Janus decision, I think that is going to become the norm, that you will see groups trying to bring more and more cases to undermine the right to collective bargaining, to undermine other ways that the law is supposed to protect collective action to the Supreme Court, because they will be very confident in predicting how those cases will come out. But I'm glad you asked the question, because in talking about this nomination with people, obviously there's a lot of attention on those issues where Justice Kennedy was often viewed as a swing vote. So reproductive rights, gay rights, and those issues are incredibly important, and it is very troubling to think about a Justice Kavanaugh, you know, voting on those kinds of cases in a way that's different than Justice Kennedy did. And I've had people say to me, well, you know, in labor cases, it's really not going to make much of a difference, because, to be honest, Justice Kennedy was not a friend to working people on cases that came before the court. He was a pretty consistent vote with the conservative majority against workers' interests. You know, in those two cases I just mentioned, he voted with the conservative majority. But I do think that I think there is reason to be concerned. I mean, we never know what happens when somebody gets to the Supreme Court, but I think there's good reason to be concerned that a Justice Kavanaugh will actually act somewhat differently than a Justice Kennedy. You know, if you look back at Kennedy's record, he authored very few opinions in worker rights cases. It wasn't an area. He was a consistent vote with the conservative majority, but it wasn't an area where he seemed to feel passionately or want to take a leadership role in shaping the law. I think if you look at Judge Kavanaugh's on the D.C. Circuit, you see him, I think, more frequently writing his own either concurrences or writing more opinions or writing dissents where he really is trying to stake out his own position. And often that position is even more extreme than the position that the party even asked the court to take on their behalf. And so, you know, I point out something I wrote recently, the case American Federation of Government Employees versus Gates,
right,
which was a Bush administration case where the Bush administration came and said, you know what, there's sort of complicated facts, but Congress passed a law that said that the Department of Defense could sort of, for a while, could make some changes in labor management relations with the career, you know, the civil service employees of the Department of Defense. And so there was a dispute arose over whether what the Bush administration wanted to do went beyond what Congress had given them permission to do. And the Bush administration went to the court and said, look, we didn't destroy collective bargaining rights. We changed them, but we're within that zone that Congress said we could do. Kavanaugh writes an opinion that says, actually, it would have been okay if they abolished collective bargaining rights. So it takes a position even more extreme than the parties brought to him. And that's the kind of case that really makes me concerned that, in fact, even though Justice Kennedy was, you know, was not somebody who ruled on the side of workers, you could see Kavanaugh. I think there's reason to be concerned that Kavanaugh will try to shape the law, will take a more active role in trying to shape the law, and that will be in a very, very conservative direction.
Yeah, and especially with regard to the attacks that the Federal Civil Service is having right now, continuing over Trump's attacks on the unions there and their right to collective bargaining. I think that's really
sure.
Something
I mean, that's,
to...
It's not hypothetical, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There is actually likely, I mean, we don't know yet in light of the D.C. District Court, Judge Jackson just recently striking down, you know, the key provisions of the executive orders that the Trump administration issued to really gut collective bargaining for federal employees. She struck those down. We don't know yet if the Trump administration is going to try to appeal her decision, and so it is not purely hypothetical that the collective bargaining rights of federal employees could end up before the Supreme Court in not too long. And so for federal employees, this the Kavanaugh nomination should seem like a very urgent and serious matter.
And the other thing that concerned me very much were issues that are part of the rights of working people. And I'm looking at issues around discrimination. And I know there was the Miller case, Miller versus Clinton,
yep,
which Kavanaugh argued to remove a group of employees from the protection of the anti-discrimination statutes. And I want you to talk more about that and indeed how issues of sexual harassment and other things are part of the body of work before the Supreme Court, and how issues of religiosity as well will fit into what we believe and understand has been the rule, if you will, of Kavanaugh and what that means for the various rights of workers as well.
Sure. So in Miller versus Clinton, the State Department, what was at issue was a worker who was employed abroad, you know, outside the United States. And so there are often complicated questions about how our laws apply to people who are working outside our, you know, the physical limits of the United States. The State Department conceded that they had fired this employee because of his age. There was, in fact, a mandatory retirement age imposed for workers like this particular employee. And they took the position that they could do that, that that was okay, because you obviously within the United States you couldn't do that. We have laws that protect older workers from discrimination. The majority on the D.C. Circuit rejected the State Department's position, but Kavanaugh dissented and said that the State Department was free to impose a mandatory retirement age and sort of overlooked and said, well, there's other parts. The Constitution can protect people against discrimination, you know, overlooked how the deficits in pursuing discrimination that way. And in fact, the Constitution doesn't protect workers from age discrimination, and there are limits on the remedy. So again, it's this. I think it fits this pattern you see in Kavanaugh's cases of not really thinking about the impact of the way that he decides cases on people's real lives, sort of not understanding the real lives of American workers and what's at issue when these cases come, come to the court. And, you know, why that is, I don't know. You know, I write a lot for a labor law blog that's done here at Harvard Law School called On Labor. And one of our regular writers, Andrew Strom, wrote a really great piece called Brett Kavanaugh, Common Sense and Class Prejudice, projecting that he just doesn't understand the lives of sort of regular American workers and therefore... You get these cases where he sides with the companies, with corporations, because he just can't really understand what those power dynamics are in the American workplace for most people.
Well, as you mentioned that, just kind of dovetailing on what I previously asked, the issue of women, most people are, you know, geared up to think about the issue of women almost exclusively in the reproductive rights area. But the issue of women, the issue of people of color and marginalized groups within the society, and then the whole issue of discrimination, which comes into play in so many labor decisions, etc. How do you think that Mr. Kavanaugh would rule in those instances that imbue to the actual rights of women, whether it's, the issue of sexual harassment in the workplace, for example, or other things? What do you think his decisions tell us about those kinds of concerns as workers?
Sure. So I'm not familiar with any cases that would directly sort of reveal how he thinks about sexual harassment. But again, you know, if you think about this pattern of cases involving workers who are the most vulnerable, who are the least powerful, you know, sadly, we know in our country that the majority of low-wage workers are women. They are people of color. And so I think these issues are, you know, the way that he has decided these labor-related cases, even if they don't directly address discrimination, again, give you this picture, this portrait of how he thinks or probably doesn't really think about the need to protect and to forcefully assert those protections in the law for people of color, for women. And so I would be very concerned, even without, a tremendous amount of evidence from his record on the D.C. Circuit about particular cases involving issues like sexual harassment or race discrimination.
So, Sharon Block, what's the takeaway?
The takeaway is that while we should be concerned about Kavanaugh's record on some of these higher profile issues that are getting most of the attention, American workers should be really, really concerned about this nomination also. And so they should make their feelings known. They should look at his record and see the way that he just is not going to be a justice that's going to stand up, I don't think, to protect the rights of American workers. And so they should be very concerned and do what you do in a democracy, which is make your voice heard.
And you wrote a very good article on that Harvard blog, which talks about some of the issues that we talked about, plus a few others. So do you want to tell us what the name of that is so people could log on to that? And it's a wonderful blog.
Sure.
I just discovered it, and it's got all kinds of wonderful
Oh, I'm so glad you did. It's called onlabor.org. And it was founded by a wonderful colleague I have here, Professor Ben Sachs, and it's really the go-to place for seeing what's up and what's new and what's going on in terms of labor law, labor policy, sort of labor current events.
And if you're not part of the solution. You are part of the problem. Thank you for helping us know thine enemy, and we have a lot of work to do to make sure that Brett Kavanaugh is not confirmed as the next Supreme Court Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And do, absolutely, do check out Sharon Block's blogs. They are very insightful, chock full of critical information that we need to know to lay the foundation for our becoming even better agents for social change. Thanks for joining us, Sharon Block.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it. Take care.
When we're trucking down Jericho walls, we don't need no trouble, you know? Yeah, Rastafari.
You're part of the problem, and I think we're clear who's part of the problem. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Mike Pence goes around saying, I'm a Christian, I'm a conservative, and I'm a Republican in that order. He doesn't say I'm an American.
Since coming out a couple of years ago, I have identified with the word gay. As I've grown older, I've come to respect the word queer more and more.
For this historic tour, they learned songs in several other languages.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Lagos birthday party arrests accelerate Nigeria's anti-gay crackdown. A young critic confronts the Q word. And Portland's gay men's chorus serenades China. Those stories and more this week now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm Brian DeShazer.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 1st, 2018. A court in Nigeria has charged 57 men with committing homosexual acts and belonging to a secret cult. Each faces up to 14 years in prison. The charges against each man also include 3 counts of conspiracy and being at an unlawful gathering. The arrests this week in a hotel banquet hall in Lagos come on the heels of a similar raid on a hotel room in the southeastern state of Abia in mid-August that netted 6 men. A few of the defendants in the latest anti-queer crackdown in Nigeria denied being gay and told the local Premium Times newspaper that it was a birthday party for one of the men. Some also insisted that there were several women at the party who were getting dressed up in a nearby room and that police officers told any of them that they saw just to leave. All 57 men entered not guilty pleas during their arraignment on August 30th, and each was ordered by the magistrate to be remanded unless bail equivalent to about $600 could be posted. The case was adjourned until September 10th. Nigerian authorities continue to trumpet multiple arrests of gay people. 42 men attending an HIV/AIDS education workshop in a hotel conference room in Lagos last year were infamously arrested and also charged with committing homosexual acts.
Bermuda's Court of Appeal is uniquely composed of foreign judges flown in for each specific case. It was announced this week that they will hear an appeal November 7th through 9th of rulings by Bermuda's Supreme Court rebuffing the government's efforts to overturn marriage equality, a law repealing marriage equality in the British Overseas Territory and replacing it with inferior domestic partnerships, took effect on June 1st this year. It gave the Caribbean island the distinction of being the first national government in the world to repeal marriage equality. But 5 days later, the portion of the law that re-banned marriage equality was struck down by the Supreme Court, the same court that had first legalized marriage equality in May 2017. If the Court of Appeal rules against it, Bermuda's government could make one final appeal to the United Kingdom Privy Council, where opponents of marriage equality would probably face an uphill battle.
Anti-queer forces in Taiwan have apparently gathered enough signatures to force a referendum on marriage equality. The island's Grand Council of Justices ruled in May 2017 that limiting civil marriage to heterosexual couples was unconstitutional. However, they gave lawmakers until May 2019 to pass marriage equality legislation. If members of the Legislative Yuan don't act by May of next year, and they seem reluctant to do so, marriage equality would come into force by default. But a petition with more than 650,000 signatures demanding a public vote on the issue was submitted to election authorities this week by a group calling itself Happiness of the Next Generation Alliance. The referendum language specifically denies marriage equality to same-gender couples and requires using means other than marriage to legally recognize those couples. If the Central Election Commission confirms the required number of valid signatures, a referendum would likely take place on November 24th to coincide with local elections already scheduled for that date. Anti-queer foes have already brought in Brian Brown of America's National Coalition for Marriage, which, having failed to stop marriage equality in the U.S., has been actively promoting discrimination elsewhere. With subtitles translating his message into Mandarin, Brown urges voters to support the referendum and protect marriage in Taiwan. LGBTQ activists have reportedly qualified a competing referendum to establish marriage equality, insisting that civil unions or something similar is not equality. While a referendum cannot directly overturn a constitutional court ruling, recent news reports say that the government is required to propose laws that comply with referenda outcomes. So the government would have to propose marriage equality or some kind of civil unions law, depending on the referenda results. If a civil unions law were enacted instead of marriage equality, that action could apparently trigger a new lawsuit.
In other news, the U.S. Supreme Court refused this week to force the city of Philadelphia to allow the foster care placement of children with Catholic social services. The church-backed agency refuses to consider applications from same-gender couples. The High Court rejected without comment the agency's request for an injunction that would have required the city to allow it to place children in foster homes headed only by heterosexual couples while litigation over the issue continues in lower courts. A majority of Supreme Court justices are required to grant an injunction. Even though it's short one justice with the pending nomination by Donald Trump of Brett Kavanaugh to fill the vacancy left by the retirement of Anthony Kennedy, only three of the current eight-member court voted to grant the injunction: Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Trump appointee Neil Gorsuch. Catholic Social Services claims that considering same-gender couples as prospective foster parents would amount to endorsing marriage equality, which church doctrine strongly opposes. The city of Philadelphia insists that every fostering and adoption agency abide by its anti-discrimination laws, which include protections for LGBTQ people. Using an increasingly familiar argument, Catholic Social Services, which is part of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, is claiming that the city is violating its constitutional rights to religious freedom and free speech.
In yet another lower court affirmation of the rights of LGBTQ people to be free from discrimination, the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled this week that under the Federal Fair Housing Act, a landlord can be liable for not protecting a tenant from documented discriminatory harassment by other tenants. The Chicago-based 7th Circuit, which reviews cases from Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin, decided that elderly lesbian Marsha Wetzel had been subjected to verbal harassment and abuse at the hands of other residents of Glen St. Andrew Living Community, a Chicago suburb senior housing facility, including three separate physical assaults, and that the landlord can be held accountable for purposefully failing to protect her. Equality activists say the Seventh Circuit decision represents a significant interpretation of the Fair Housing Act in declaring that the law protects LGBTQ people from discrimination. Karen Lowy of Lambda Legal, which is representing Wetzel, called it a tremendous victory. The lawsuit can now continue in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, which had dismissed the case. The court today struck a blow for me and for all senior citizens, gay or straight, Wetzel said in a Lambda Legal press release, who deserve to feel safe and to be treated with respect. That's not too much to ask. No one should have to endure what I endured because of who I am.
Meanwhile, a group of 16 states is urging the U.S. Supreme Court to rule that companies can fire workers based on their sexual orientation or gender identity without violating federal workplace anti-discrimination laws. They argue that Congress didn't intend the ban on discrimination based on sex in Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act to cover lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender employees. A few lower courts have already ruled that Title VII does indeed protect LGBTQ people, while other courts have rejected that idea. The August 23rd Friend of the Court brief, spearheaded by Nebraska Attorney General Doug Peterson, specifically targets an appeals court decision against a Michigan funeral home that fired a transgender worker, currently being considered for review by the U.S. Supreme Court, and asserts that Title VII's protections based on sex are limited only to biologically born women. A total of 13 Republican attorneys general, including those representing Texas, Alabama, Kansas, and Utah, signed on to the brief. Three GOP governors, Kentucky's Matthew Bevin, Maine's Paul LePage, and Mississippi's Phil Bryant, also joined in the court filing. The Supreme Court is expected to decide in the coming months whether to take up the Michigan case. It's been asked to consider two other cases, testing whether bias based on sexual orientation is also a form of sex discrimination banned under Title VII.
And finally, a judge in the state of Utah made news this week when he declared that 74-year-old Bonnie Forrester was legally wed to her common-law spouse, Beverly Guessant, who died in May at the age of 82, a few weeks after the couple celebrated their 50th anniversary together. Their attorney, Roger Houle, proposed the unusual action. Judge Patrick Corum decided that the couple could be considered married since December 20, 2013, when the state opened civil marriage to same-gender couples, or even sometime in 1968, when the couple began living together, although that would require a more complex legal process. According to Corum, this was Utah's second posthumous marriage of a same-gender couple. A previous case declared a woman married to her deceased partner who had died in a car crash. Bonnie Forrester, who says Beverly Guessant was her soulmate, told the Salt Lake Tribune that she was numb from happiness. "I'm a married woman," she said. "I've waited 50 years.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending September 1st, 2018. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the always evolving thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
Ironically, queer is no longer used as commonly as a slur as gay is. But beyond that, the word queer puts power back in our hands.
What's the right word? Later in the program. What's behind the adoring gaze? What makes a vice president so slavishly mimic his boss that he's even caught on camera moving his bottled water to match? Mike Pence's own potential presidential buzz had been pretty much silenced after his disastrous support as governor for Indiana's ill-fated religious freedom law. But then Donald Trump's now convicted ex-campaign manager Paul Manafort oiled Pence's way into the number two spot on the 2016 Republican presidential ticket. By all accounts, Pence not only fervently believes in God, but more dangerously, he's sure that God believes in Pence, and that all the madness of the Trump administration is God's mysterious method to elevate Pence and his conservative, godly agenda. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael D'Antonio talked about his new biography of Pence on CNN.
Mike Pence goes around saying, "I'm a Christian, I'm a conservative, and I'm a Republican," in that order. He doesn't say, "I'm an American." He actually sort of heard in his being God's direction. And he thought that God was calling him to now be vice president and function as a president in waiting. We see Donald Trump in this huge crisis, this rolling chaos. And I think with every day, Mike Pence imagines he's one day closer to the Oval Office. I think he's positioning himself to be the normal guy, the guy you can trust. And he would like to impose a religiously inspired politics on our country. That means rolling back marriage equality. It means a ban on abortion, a whole host of policies that are religiously driven. And he's very upfront about it.
That was Michael D'Antonio, co-author with Peter Eisner of The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence, published by Thomas Dunn Books.
Portland will be giving glimpses of life in the U.S. through song, all while experiencing life in China.
Yi Lu Ping An.
Or Bon Voyage. But first,
what's the word? What's the word? What's the word?
LGBT people who object to the use of the word queer usually cite that word's negative legacy. But what happens when the word gay becomes a pejorative?
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Lucas, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Alex talks about the gay rights movement's reclamation of certain slurs and how he feels that queer is a more fitting label for him than just gay.
An effective civil rights movement has to do more than just sway public opinion in order to instill long-lasting change. Specifically, one task that most modern rights movements have faced is trying to change the public's vocabulary surrounding a topic. Both the feminist and black civil rights movements challenged the American people's views on certain words. In particular, the gay rights movement has battled to reclaim words that had been traditionally used as slurs against us. In a little more than half a century, the United States went from using the word queer as a slur to using it as a word of inclusion for any non-cisgender and non-heterosexual self-identification. As I've grown older, I've come to respect the word queer more and more, particularly because I've come to doubt the prevalence of the word gay. Since coming out a couple of years ago, I have identified with the word gay. It was the word that I was most familiar with, and it made sense. Largely, I haven't had any problems with using the word. I find that it accurately describes my sexuality, as I'm someone who is attracted to people of the same gender as myself. But my issues with the word have grown since my first coming out. It started with hearing gay filling the place that the word queer used to occupy. Lots of teenagers my age throw around the word gay as a descriptor for anything effeminate. Even when I looked up the word effeminate while writing this piece, to make sure that my definition of the word was correct, Google suggested pictures of gay actors and rainbow flags to me. Even beyond this, kids call plenty of random things gay, just as a general insult. Trying hard in school is gay, apparently, as I overheard recently. The use of the word gay to describe effeminacy in men supports a false stereotype, that all gay men are feminine, as well as an incorrect interpretation of what the word gay means. Gay describes sexuality, not gender. I'm not ready to use any word other than male in describing my gender. And I find that the word gay to describe myself only supports this stereotype. How can I be effeminate, gay, and cisgender without fueling this? Is that conscionable? I don't want to have to grapple with this problem whenever I think about my identity, which is something that I should resonate with, of course. Using the word queer solves some of these issues. Ironically, queer is no longer used as commonly as a slur as gay is. But beyond that, the word queer puts power back in our hands. The word queer was reclaimed as a unification of gay men and lesbian women during a wave of angry, radical protest in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, queer unifies more than just those two groups. We tore it out of the dictionary and put it back in as something entirely new. I like that queer implies some deviation from both the gender and sexuality binaries, unlike the word gay, which only describes sexuality. And I'm not sure I can say that I fall into the strict categories of cisgender and gay anymore. I've only just started to consider this change. But this thinking brings me back to the inexplicable first question that starts everyone's coming out process. I'm beginning to think that for me, the word queer might be a better answer than gay.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producer is Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
That's my word, that's my word, that's my word.
Hey, everybody, this is Leah Delaria, and you are listening to This Way Out.
Portland, Oregon's Gay Men's Chorus has gone where no queer chorus has gone before. This Way Out correspondent Steve Sims has the story.
I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone.
While they did not take a slow boat to China, the Portland Gay Men's Chorus is in China. That is the Portland Gay Men's Chorus during their final rehearsal before leaving on a historic trip. 2 years in the planning, Portland Gay Men's Chorus is on a four-city tour of the People's Republic of China, and they will be the very first community chorus to tour and perform in the country. They will visit Beijing, Xi'an, Suzhou, and Shanghai. Their first concert will be a joint concert in Beijing with the Beijing Queer Chorus, who visited Portland in March. Portland Gay Men's Chorus was founded in 1980, starting with just 26 singers. Today they are a thriving arts organization with 150-plus singers. Portland's host in Beijing, the Beijing Queer Chorus, originally called the Shiny Jazzy Chorus, was founded in 2008, the year of the Beijing Olympics. The LGBT Center in Beijing decided they'd like to have a performing face. The music selected for the tour demonstrates two rich musical traditions from the United States, songs for Broadway and musical theater. The songs all have geographical references and makes for a fun way to share a little bit about the USA. The selections take you from New England, New York, and Baltimore. Down to the American South and New Orleans.
Louisiana Purchase. I'll tell you what it means. It means I'd like to sell you New Orleans. Come on, come on, and you all can go to town way down in New Orleans.
Up the Mississippi to St. Louis, into Iowa, across the wide Missouri. And on to Oregon.
Hail
to thee, land of promise, my Oregon. Oregon.
The first three songs are part of the concert tour. New York, New York, performed there by the Boston Gay Men's Chorus. Louisiana Purchase, performed there by the original New York cast. Across the Wide Missouri, which was performed there by the Beijing Queer Chorus at a rehearsal at Reed College in Portland during their March 2018 visit. The last song, Oregon, My Oregon by Ian Dosher, will not be on the tour program. There will be a song, though, by Tom Simmons called Oregon. For this historic tour, they learned songs in several other languages. In addition to Mandarin, they learned an Aboriginal language, Korean, Portuguese, Spanish, and Hawaiian. Here now is the Portland Gay Men's Chorus singing the iconic work Never Never in Mandarin. Portland will be giving glimpses of life in the U.S. through song, all while experiencing life in China. Scheduled sightseeing trips include Tiananmen Square, Imperial Palace in the Forbidden City, and the Terracotta Museum. They will also take a rickshaw tour, visit a jade factory, and attend a calligraphy lecture. In the end, though, the tour is about connecting through music. The Portland Gay Men's Chorus, led by Executive Director Rick Young, who first had the idea for this tour, and who himself is half Chinese, departed on August 30th, and they will be in the People's Republic of China until September 9th. You can learn more at pdxgmc.org. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Sims.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Michelle Yater and Brian DeShazer, from Outcasting Overtime's Lucas and Alex, produced by Mark Sulfus, and from Steve Sims. Stoppa performed some of the music you heard, and Tim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who all make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KOOP Austin, Texas, Lofty Community Radio, Adelaide Hills, South Australia, WHYS Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Are women who've suffered brutal physical abuse at the hands of their partners, are they entitled to asylum protection in the U.S.? Getting asylum depends on a number of things, including the kind of persecution that a person has suffered and her or his ability to get a fair hearing in the U.S. Recently, another obstacle to asylum was erected by none other than U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who invoked a rarely used power to refer an important asylum case to himself. That case involved a Salvadoran woman who endured 15 years of severe abuse at the hands of her husband and then ex-husband. After this nation's highest immigration court approved her asylum claim in December 2016, a hostile lower court judge and then Sessions himself intervened. What this case means and what it augurs is of immense importance, not just to refugee law and asylum adjudications in this country, but to the lives and well-being of domestic violence survivors who face a significant risk of further violence and indeed death if sent back to their home countries. Cases like the one Sessions referred to himself have been closely monitored by Karen Musallo, a law professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, where she directs the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. Musallo has written extensively on refugee law issues and has litigated a number of landmark cases. In fact, the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies is co-counsel in a case that challenges the way the Salvadoran woman's case is being applied at the border. When Karen Musallo joined me recently in studio, I asked her what the woman, who is called A.B. in court documents, suffered at the hands of her husband in El Salvador.
Well, shortly after they married, he became very abusive, really within a year or so of them getting together. And the abuse took many forms, from beatings and kickings, threatening her with knives, threatening her with guns, threatening to hang her by a rope from the ceiling. They had three children together. The abuse continued throughout the pregnancies, you know, throughout the children that she bore. He was just vicious. He made the home sort of tantamount to a torture chamber. And he felt that he had the total right to act this way with impunity, because violence against women, many women's rights activists in El Salvador and human rights lawyers in El Salvador, you know, will readily concede that violence against women is quite normalized, not just tolerated, but really seen as the norm. And that sort of translates to this sense of absolute power that her husband had to treat her as he wanted. You know, there was no recourse for her. He had a brother who was a member of the police force and basically said to her that you won't get any recourse if you go to the police. And his brother even joined in the death threats to Miss A.B.
Now, she did approach the police, the authorities. What happened? Did they take measures to stop the abuse?
So she did, on at least two occasions, go to the police. And the police really were not very responsive. And I think the lack of taking this seriously is perhaps best demonstrated by the fact that on one occasion, after she had been terrorized and beaten by her husband and she went to the police, they issued her a temporary restraining order, which is something that exists under Salvadoran law. There have been a number of laws that have been enacted in El Salvador to address violence against women. It's a whole other story we could go into as to how they're absolutely ineffective, not properly implemented, have not reduced violence or reduced levels of impunity. But having said that, she did in fact get a temporary restraining order or protective order from the police. And then the police said to her, why don't you go serve this on your husband? And so you just have to think of the absolute absurdity of that. A woman who is terrorized, who has just been beaten by this abusive spouse, and who knows that having gone to the police will just enrage him even more, and then go to the police and they give her a protective order and they say, hey, why don't you go home and serve this on your husband? And the violence continued over a number of years with no checks on it by any of the authorities.
At one point, the police told her to leave the area. Where did she go and what happened?
Yeah, the police made a comment like, if you had any dignity, you would leave. Sort of like saying, you know, we're not here to protect you. You should protect yourself. And why don't you go somewhere? So she actually moved several hours away, and her husband was easily able to track her down to ascertain her whereabouts. And he came there and continued the abuse. And at a certain point, she even divorced him. And the comments that he and that his brother, the police officer, made it clear that the divorce was really meaningless to them. A comment was made, if you think this divorce will set you free, you're sadly mistaken. You will, you know, sort of always belong to him, to your spouse. And I think that goes to the fact that there is this attitude that's part of sort of a very deeply entrenched patriarchy or machismo. And again, not my words, but really women activists within El Salvador, there's this sense of treating women as property. And once, you know, they're property of their fathers, and then they're the property of the men that they're with, and that they don't have the autonomy. It's just not within the conceptualization of gender relations that the woman has the right to terminate that relationship.
So this woman called A.B. in the court documents, she comes to the U.S. and applies for asylum. And let's step back here and ask you, what do you have to prove in order to be granted asylum?
So I will answer that. I want to just back up one point, because I think this is important, that when she moved and when she divorced him And she saw that that was totally ineffective in stopping his abuse. In fact, the abuse not only continued, but there were a series of very serious death threats from both her, by this time, her former spouse, and his friends, and the brother-in-law, really saying, you know, be careful, you don't know where the bullets are going to fly, or, you know, you might end up dead, cut in little pieces in a plastic bag thrown in a river. And she took these threats very seriously, because in El Salvador, as in a number of the other Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the level of gender-motivated killings, or femicides, as they're called, is quite high. These are countries that have the highest levels of femicides in the world. And so when she was threatened in that way, that was really the final sort of point for her. That was a catalyst, the recognition that moving away, divorcing him, wouldn't make her safe, and that really the only option that she had was to leave the country. And so that was the point at which she fled. And this was after about 15 years of continuous abuse and threats. So then, returning to your question about the legal requirements for asylum, so for an individual to be granted asylum in the United States, they have to meet the definition of a refugee. And that definition is in the 1980 Refugee Act, enacted by Congress and based on international documents, the 1957 Refugee Convention and its 1967 Protocol. And it defines a refugee as an individual either who has suffered persecution or has a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So the person has to either have suffered harm or have what's called a well-founded fear of harm. And it can't be just, you know, that they're afraid for any reason. It has to be that the reason that they are being targeted is somehow related to one of these five grounds that we call the protective grounds: the race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and membership in a particular social group. That's really the core definition.
What happens when the applicant, this is again the applicant for asylum in the U.S., when the person persecuting that person is not a governmental entity or actor? What must the applicant show or prove?
Right. So this is in part the way in which the definition has been interpreted, that persecutor can be either the government or what we call a non-state actor. So individuals who are, could be members of the family, could be members of society, could be gangs, could be cartels, could be vigilantes, could be white supremacists, you name sort of, we know there are lots of groups that are not per se the government formally, but are groups in society that may engage in violence. And so when the persecutor is what we call a non-state actor, the individual has to also prove that the government is either unable or unwilling to protect the person. And the rationale of that is that if the government can protect a person, can provide effective protection, the person is not in need of protection in another country as a refugee.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Karen Musallo joins me in studio. She is professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings College of the Law. And we will talk more about what happens to the case of Ms. AB and her application for asylum in the U.S. But I want to ask you now about a key piece of background for what happens to her case, which is a decision that the Board of Immigration Appeals made in 2014. It was called the case of Matter of ARCG. So can you talk about that? And maybe we could start with the woman who was at the center of that case. She was Guatemalan. What did she suffer at the hands of her spouse?
So unfortunately, she suffered in ways very similar to Miss AB, just an endless, unrelenting physical and verbal and sexual abuse. The physical abuse included her husband throwing acid at her and burning her skin. I believe it was her breast that was very badly burned. She suffered broken bones. She suffered beatings and kickings so severe when she was pregnant that her child was actually, the baby was actually born with bruises. And, you know, I have to say, for those of your listeners who might think these cases are exceptional within the context of the countries we're talking about, I have to say, all too unfortunately, that these are not uncommon, that this level of violence is all too common. So Miss ARCG suffered this, you know, again until she reached a point where she felt it was unbearable and her saving her life really required her leaving her her spouse, and she came to the U.S. and sought asylum. And I should mention that this issue of whether or not women who are survivors of brutal domestic violence, whether or not they qualify for asylum, had been a long-running dispute in U.S. law going back at least to 1999, which was the first kind of published decision or precedential decision on this issue. And it had been debated back and forth with three different attorneys general of the United States getting involved in this question, which really shows how, in a way, controversial it was. It was Janet Reno and then John Ashcroft and then Michael Mukasey. But finally, in 2014, the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is sort of like the Supreme Court in the immigration system, so immigration decisions by the Board of Immigration Appeals are binding precedent for what we call immigration judges and asylum officers who are decision makers. And the Board of Immigration Appeals finally in 2014 issued a precedent that said, yes, women who are fleeing domestic violence can meet this refugee definition. And, you know, here is how we analyze it. And I should mention that when the Board of Immigration Appeals did that, it was also had been supported, taking that position had been advocated by the Department of Homeland Security itself, which represents the government in these proceedings. And the Department of Homeland Security at its sort of highest policy levels had decided that this was the proper approach to take. And so they urged the Board of Immigration Appeals to do that. And that 2014 decision really brought to a conclusion, or so we thought, this long-running controversy about whether or not women in this situation met the refugee definition.
So this is the Board of Immigration Appeals decision, again, in August 2014. It was the matter of ARCG. So you told me that the successful applicant for asylum must fear persecution because of one of five protected grounds: race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So on what basis or on what protected grounds did the board, the BIA, approve asylum for Ms. ARCG?
So they approved it on the ground of membership in a particular social group, with that social group really being defined by different characteristics of Miss ARCG and or more broadly, sort of more broadly looking at Guatemalan society and defining it by the fact that she was a woman in Guatemala who was in this relationship to her husband. And I should probably step back and for some of your listeners and just explain a little bit so that this makes a little bit more sense to them. So these five grounds: race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and membership in a particular social group were sort of the grounds that were named for protection when the refugee definition first came into existence. And that membership in a particular social group was added. We're talking about a treaty that was drafted back in 1951. And many people think that ground was put in there to protect categories of people that might not be encompassed by those other four grounds of race, religion, nationality, or political opinion.
Yeah, it's a pretty general category.
It's general, but what the courts in the U.S. had ruled about membership in a particular social group going back to 1985 when they were asked, how do we define this? And this was actually in a case not having anything to do with women fleeing gender violence. But what the board – this was another decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals in 1985, and it said, well, those other grounds, race, religion, nationality, and political opinion, what do they have in common? Because this fifth ground should probably be interpreted in a way that's consistent with how we understand those other grounds. And the Board of Immigration Appeals said, well, those grounds all describe things about a person that they either can't change or shouldn't have to change. So race and nationality, you can't change if you think of nationality as meaning place of birth. And religion and political opinion, you shouldn't have to change to avoid persecution. So the board said, well, membership of a particular social group, therefore, should be defined by characteristics about a person that they can't change or shouldn't have to change. And they gave as an example a social group that was defined in part by gender. And so that had been a position that going back to the 1980s and that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees had also advocated that when women are persecuted because of things that have to do with their gender, that particular social group is really often the appropriate ground. And you could define, you know, it could be something like Cameroonian widows or Kenyan girls subject to female genital cutting. But it's you look at the gender and then what are other things about the person that describe the reason why she's being persecuted? And so that particular social group, ARCG, what the board did in 2014 in its decision in ARCG was not really something ground-shaking or going out on a limb or really stretching to find that she could be included or protected within the particular social group ground. It was simply coming to a conclusion that for 20 or 30 years had been – you know, advocated by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and adopted by many countries around the world when they apply the refugee definition.
That's Karen Musallo. She is a law professor and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings College of the Law. Yeah, this ARCG decision, as you've indicated to me via the materials you sent me, has been reaffirmed numerous times. So let's now go back to the later case of the matter of AB, this Miss AB, who you told had to endure 15 years of severe domestic violence and abuse at the hands of her husband and then ex-husband in El Salvador. So who heard her asylum case? So she gets here and she's assigned a judge. Who heard her case and how did that judge rule?
So she had the misfortune to have her case heard by a judge, V. Stewart Couch, C-O-U-C-H, who sits in Charlotte. And he is known for having one of the highest denial rates of asylum seekers nationwide, way beyond what the sort of national average is, and seems to have a particular bias against claims involving domestic violence. And this was shown by a Freedom of Information Act request that a colleague did of his cases. And so she had the misfortune to appear in front of Judge Couch, who, for a number of reasons, denied her. One part of his decision was just disbelieving, you know, key aspects of her claim, invoking reasons that really were absolutely absurd and would have been laughable if it wasn't just so cruel to disbelieve her. And so when he denied her, she appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is the body that we've been talking about that issued ARCG in 2014. And the board reversed Judge Couch. The board basically it went through his reasons for not finding her credible and found that they were not a legitimate basis for disbelieving her story. And then the board applied the principle of ARCG to her case and said she should be granted asylum. And the board sent the case back to Judge Couch for the sole purpose of carrying out the security check that is done on every asylum seeker before he or she can be issued a grant.
So Ms. A.B. is justifiably elated by this decision by this three-member BIA panel, which reversed Judge Couch's decision. So is that the end of the story?
No, and unfortunately, and I think this just gives, if not the appearance of bias, the actual sort of proof of bias by Judge Couch, he basically disobeyed the BIA order. He sat on the case. Months went by. If I'm not mistaken, it was 8 months that went by. And then the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, in other words, the federal circuit court that covers this, you know, North Carolina, this area, issued a decision in a case that had nothing to do with domestic violence. But Judge Couch seized upon that decision and said, oh, the analysis in this decision shows that ARCG is incorrect, and therefore I'm not going to issue a grant. In fact, I'm going to send this case back up to the BIA. I'm sending it to the BIA. And I should note that what he did, you know, sitting on it all that time obviously gives the appearance of impropriety. The case that he used to justify it, that he said was the reason why ARCG was no longer viable, legally, you know, most people would say legally incorrect. But this other thing of sending it back to the board, he had no legal authority to do that. And shortly after, the Attorney General Sessions learned about this case, and rather than letting the board review it again, the Attorney General reached out and took this case and said, I'm going to decide this case now. And there's another sort of, at least the appearance of impropriety, or one could speculate that Judge Couch was in communication with the Attorney General and flagging this case. So there's a number of things that just raise some, you know, serious questions about the bias and inappropriate or improper acts on the part of the immigration judge.
Karen Musallo is her name. She teaches law at UC Hastings College of the Law. She is also founding director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. We'll take a short break and speak more with Karen. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Karen Musallo is my guest, M-U-S-A-L-O. She is professor of law at UC Hastings. She directs the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She's lead co-author of Refugee Law and Policy, a Comparative and International Approach which is now in its fifth edition. And she was the first attorney to partner with psychologists in the representation of traumatized asylum seekers. She also edited the first handbook for practitioners on cross-cultural issues and on the impact of culture on credibility in the asylum context. So Jeff Sessions refers this case, the case of Miss AB, to himself for a decision. Under what authority did he take this case over?
So the attorney, there is a regulation that allows the attorney general to take a decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals and to take jurisdiction over it and to decide it. But technically, this case was not at the Board of Immigration Appeals. And for lawyers, you know, regulations and rules and how things are supposed to be done, I mean, they create rights that are not supposed to be violated. This case was no longer in front of the Board of Immigration Appeals. The Board of Immigration Appeals had sent it back to the judge, and it was actually in front of the judge awaiting decision. So having said that, yes, he does have authority to take any decision. And I should mention, this might be a little bit of a side track here or side path, but the attorney generals do have this authority, and this attorney general Sessions has exercised it more aggressively than any of his predecessors. He has reached out, I think it was within a six-month period, he reached out and took four different BIA decisions with which he disagreed, because many of them gave certain rights to immigrants or asylum seekers, and reversed or vacated those decisions. So just to say that this is within that very aggressive position that he's taken and the administration has taken about trying to turn back immigrant rights and refugee rights.
So on March 7th of this year, Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General of the U.S., refers the case to himself. 3 months later, on June 11th of this year, he hands down a decision. What did he decide and how did he justify it?
Well, he decided that ARCG, the 2014 decision in which the BIA had said that claims of women fleeing domestic violence could meet the refugee definition, he said that it was wrongly decided, and he vacated it. And then once he vacated it, he then reversed the board's grant of asylum to Miss AB, and he sent the case back to Judge Couch for it to be decided now under the rules that he set forth in this lengthy decision. And I should say that he didn't just vacate matter of ARCG, but he issued these broad sweeping statements about claims in general, about claims involving women fleeing domestic violence, claims involving individual fleeing gangs, and issued these broad conclusory statements about how, generally speaking, these claims wouldn't meet the refugee definition because of this, that, and the other. But there's a whole body of law, refugee law, that's out there. You know, as I mentioned, the Refugee Act was enacted in 1980, and we have 38 years of precedent. And so with or without ARCG, these cases can meet the refugee definition. And it's simply inappropriate to try to use this position. You know, we talk about people having a bully pulpit. Well, I actually talk about him as being a bully. He's trying to use this one decision to send a message to immigration judges, to asylum officers, to deny all of these cases. And it's having an effect because some of the guidance that has come out around how his decision is to be applied actually adopts that position, as if you could broadly foreclose whole categories of cases without doing an individualized case-by-case determination. He also, in his decision, in addition to reversing ARCG, we think that he clearly misrepresented what the law requires, and that he also paid absolutely no attention to any of the facts in the case.
Let's talk about another case that you are very interested in. In fact, the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies is co-counsel on. It's called Grace v. Sessions, and it has to do with, as I understand it, 12 plaintiffs who went through a series of horrific abuses. I mean, each one went through his or her own set of outrages. One person was targeted by gangs. A number of people were targeted by men that they knew. It was domestic violence, gender-based abuse. Maybe one way to get into Grace versus Sessions is to talk about what a credible fear interview is and what it tries to establish.
Yeah, so to explain credible fear interview, I have to explain this change in immigration law that goes back to 1996. Because before 1996, any individual who arrived to the U.S. at the border or was within the U.S. had the right to apply for asylum. You didn't have to establish anything before you had that right. We had the 1980 Refugee Act, and it said any person in the U.S. or at a port of entry or in between a port of entry can apply for asylum. And then in 1996, this was sort of another time when we had a rise of anti-immigrant restrictionism. There was this broad, quite restrictive Immigration Act passed, and it had a provision in it called expedited removal. And one of the main features of expedited removal is it took away that right of any individual who arrived to the U.S. to apply for asylum. And it put in a screening mechanism, and it said, henceforth, any individual who arrives to the U.S. who doesn't have a legal right to enter, you know, a visa or something of that nature, and most asylum seekers don't have legal documents to enter. So expedited removal said any individual who doesn't have a legal right to enter can be immediately removed without any access to a judge, to a court, to anything. Although if they are fearful, they have to first express that to a Border Patrol officer, and then the Border Patrol officer is supposed to send them to an asylum officer to have what's called a credible fear interview. And at that credible fear interview, the law requires that the individual establish what's called a significant possibility that they could establish eligibility for asylum. So in other words, we're saying, is this person a bona fide asylum seeker? Is there some possibility, a significant possibility, that they could meet that definition of a person with a well-founded fear of persecution on account of one of these grounds? If they are found to have a credible fear, then they are allowed to pursue a case for asylum in the United States. If they are not found to have a credible fear when they're interviewed by an asylum officer, they have one opportunity for a review. It's to an immigration judge. And if the immigration judge concurs with the asylum officer that they have not met that standard, then they are immediately removed. They have no access to any higher court. And I just want to underscore how dramatic of a change that is in U.S. law, because prior to 1996, an individual seeking asylum didn't have to be screened in, simply had the right to apply and to pursue his or her case all the way up into the federal courts.
And we could talk about you characterize the standard of a significant possibility of the person establishing eligibility for asylum as a relatively low standard. It's not like they have to say, prove that they are actually eligible for asylum, that they deserve a grant of asylum right then and there because they've proven everything they need to get asylum. We could talk about why the low standard, but I feel like we need to move forward. I'm wondering what the USCIS, this is the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, what it said on July 11th of this year about this screening threshold, this threshold that people have to basically meet when they have a credible fear interview.
Right. So USCIS, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security, USCIS, its employees are asylum officers. And asylum officers are the ones conducting these credible fear interviews. So USCIS sent out guidance to its asylum officers about screening the credible fear process and basically said in bold point font that in general, claims that are based on domestic violence or gang violence will not establish a credible fear of persecution. So this was a dramatic change, and clearly it was, you know, explicitly and expressly citing to the Attorney General's decision in matter of AB to reach this, I think, absolutely erroneous conclusion that we could prejudge these claims and generally speaking, they're not going to establish this low screening standard and therefore they should just be not permitted to apply for asylum. They should just be removed.
What is the guidance, again, from USCIS? What does it do to the standard that, and you expressed this earlier, that home governments, this is part of meeting the requirements for asylum, that home governments be unable or unwilling to protect a person?
The USCIS guidance, along with what the Attorney General has said, really diverges from the law. So, you know, for decades, the standard has been if you're persecuted by a non-state actor, you have to show the government is unable or unwilling. But what the Attorney General sort of converted those to is not just unable, but absolutely helpless. You know, you have to show the government is absolutely helpless to protect you, or not just unwilling, but actually complicit. And so this ratcheting up of the standard and really diverging from what the law is, we think is clearly legally erroneous. And applying it at the screening stage, which is supposed to be a low level of screening, is particularly egregious and incorrect. We haven't said this, but if I could just briefly say, you know, credible fear interview happens almost immediately after a person arrives at the U.S. They are often not represented by an attorney. They don't know anything about the legal standard. They haven't had anybody help them prepare their case. And now they're supposed to put forth what, generally speaking, you wouldn't have to establish until you got to a full asylum hearing where you would have documentation and put in all the evidence about the government's failure to protect you.
Karen Musallo teaches law at UC Hastings College of the Law, where she is director, founding director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. What does this USCIS guidance of July 11th say about asylum applicants with a personal relationship to their persecutors? So, for example, the case of an applicant who has been beaten and abused by their husband.
Yeah, so this is really the kind of analysis that is a throwback to a way of thinking about violence against women that really, you know, should be in the dustbins of history. I mean, the way in which the Attorney General and then USCIS following the Attorney General tries to characterize domestic violence is it's just a private personal dispute. And so therefore the abuser is not targeting his wife or his partner because she's a member of this particular social group, that she's a woman in Guatemala. He's targeting her because it's just a private dispute. And it's sort of tantamount to saying that domestic violence has nothing to do with gender. This is just a personal dispute. But this isn't like a man going across the street and having a conflict with his male neighbor across the street. This is happening within the context of an intimate relationship and all of the sort of gender dynamics and power relations. It is on account of this woman's gender. And I guess the other piece of it is that characterizing it as sort of a private dispute, this goes back to, again, another long-rejected concept that women's rights are not human rights. They're just like private dispute. And, you know, in the international human rights community, it was recognized a long time ago that, no, women's rights are human rights. This isn't just a personal dispute. This is a violation of human rights, and the government has a responsibility to protect.
On August 7th, the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings, which you direct, UC Hastings College of the Law, and the ACLU filed suit on behalf of 12 plaintiffs. Each presented claims to a screening officer, meritorious claims, according to the center and the ACLU, but were denied. So what does this suit ask for? What kind of relief is this suit requesting, demanding?
So basically, this change in the credible fear standard is this direct result of the decision in AB and the USCIS's guidance. And, you know, what we're asking for, the relief we're asking for, is to declare these new credible fear policies contrary to law. We ask that they be vacated, that the policies and the written guidance that that direct them, that they be vacated, that the government be prohibited from applying these policies in credible fear interviews, and that the individuals who are the named plaintiffs who were found not to establish a credible fear, that the order against them, the order that they be removed and not be permitted to seek asylum, that be vacated and they be given a new opportunity, a new credible fear interview under the proper standard.
There are other forms of gender violence that frequently arise in claims made by female asylum seekers. We've been talking a lot about domestic violence, but other practices include forced marriage, rape, sexual slavery, trafficking for labor or sexual exploitation, honor killings, and repressive social norms, for example, forbidding education or employment. And we've talked about some legal precedents that have been established in the U.S. around domestic violence, although I guess they are now in peril because of Jeff Sessions and the USCIS actions. Do binding legal precedents exist in the U.S. that assure protection for women who have encountered, you know, these other practices that I mentioned?
There is some clear precedent in some areas involving different forms of gender violence. And I know it sounds a little mushy, but for instance, it's been pretty well established now that in claims involving female genital cutting, that women who flee that can be considered members of a particular social group and be eligible for asylum. And I'm sure that your listeners who are, you know, very thoughtful people are sort of asking the question, well, if you can say women are a particular social group when they fear female genital cutting, then why wouldn't you say they're a particular social group when they fear domestic violence? And that's exactly right. This sort of distinction that has been made makes no sense because as the law has developed around these claims, there is this recognition that when women are harmed because of their gender, they fit within the particular social group ground. So there's clear precedent on female genital cutting. There is some positive precedent for women fleeing honor killings, for women fleeing trafficking for sexual exploitation. There's less clear precedent in some of these other areas, such as forced marriage, and now we see with domestic violence. So it's a bit of a moving target, and there's just some very deep-seated resistance to the fact that women fleeing gender violence have the right to protection. And it really, I mean, I understand the kind of, I have to say it, misogyny that underlies this, but it really makes no sense to me conceptually why people think that women fleeing these kind of harms where the government can't or won't protect them, why they don't meet the refugee definition under the social group ground. It just it doesn't make sense conceptually.
Many people fear that you open the door to some refugees and you thereby open a floodgate. And, you know, a lot of people could think, well, there are a lot of women who suffer abuse in various parts of the globe. And so if we start allowing them to not only apply for asylum, but get asylum in the U.S., we're just going to be flooded with women. What's your response to this floodgates argument?
Yeah, so there's really four things that I could say really quickly. One is, you know, I was the lead attorney in a case called Matter of Kasinga, which established the precedent in 1996 that women who flee female genital cutting qualify for asylum. And before the grant of asylum, I debated a lot of people. And the argument always was, this is going to open the floodgate. Do you know how many millions of women are subject to female genital cutting? They're all going to come to the U.S. if we, you know, grant asylum. The precedent was established in 1996. The government tracked the numbers of asylum claims from women fleeing female genital cutting. It was small. There was absolutely no, like, explosion of claims. Canada has accepted gender claims going back to 1993, if I'm not mistaken. They've looked at the numbers. No explosion of claims. So it just doesn't bear out that there's an explosion of claims or floodgates. But then I would say two other things, even if there were. You know, on the basis of the law and what the law requires, you know, we have obligated ourselves through domestic law and international law to protect people fleeing persecution. And the reason we have refugee, you know, international refugee protections is because of the failure of protection of people fleeing the Holocaust. And so floodgates is simply not an excuse. It wouldn't have been an excuse to say there's too many Jews. I mean, that's what people essentially did. And it was wrong then, was morally wrong then, is morally wrong now. And I would just say to people who fear, you know, the floodgates and don't want to protect refugees, the smarter way to avoid a floodgate and the moral and ethical way is address the root causes. Why are people fleeing? And correct those conditions. Work, you know, have a smart foreign policy, have smart policies, and work with countries to eliminate gender violence or eliminate, you know, violence against certain racial or ethnic or religious minorities. That's the way to avoid the floodgates. But throwing somebody fleeing persecution, you know, throwing somebody who's running out of a burning house back into that burning building, it is simply, you know, fundamentally so immoral and so wrong and just not justifiable on a legal basis either.
And there are reasons you cited, and it goes back to the conditions of women in their home countries. There are reasons why applications from abused women have not skyrocketed after positive decisions from U.S. or, for example, Canadian authorities.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reasons that they haven't skyrocketed are, you know, for many individuals, they don't want to leave everything they love behind, leave their family, leave their children, leave their lives, their language. So it's not so easy. It's not like everybody wants to come to the U.S. I know many people think that, but they don't want to come. So the numbers have not skyrocketed. And in many of these countries, women have so few civil and political rights that it just is not feasible for them to leave and come to the U.S. So I think there's lots of pragmatic reasons why there haven't been floodgates, even though we have accepted, you know, an extended protection to certain people.
Your center, and again, this is the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings College for the Law, recently launched an advocacy campaign called Immigrant Women 2. Tell us about it.
So in addition to the litigation and other work that we're doing to challenge and try to turn back the Attorney General's policy, we hope to mobilize public opinion, to mobilize public opposition to this very broadly. And we think that this is an issue that shouldn't just be of concern to people who care about refugees or immigrants, but really this is fundamentally a women's rights issue and a human rights issue. And, you know, in the same way that Me Too and Time's Up is about recognizing the rights that women have, broadly speaking, we'd like to mobilize and sort of partner with people across the country who feel that it is wrong to send a woman back to her death. And so this campaign, we are just at the beginning stages of it, but we are going to, you know, provide people with different suggested ways to join the conversation, to express their opinions and their opposition to policymakers at particular, you know, points in time. And we have, if you go to our website at the immigrantwomen2.org that we've established for the campaign, or hashtag immigrantwomen2, and it's 2 spelled T-O-O, you can find out more about the campaign. Or you can you know, follow me on Twitter. I tweet about it occasionally, and it's at Karen Musallo. So those are various things that if you want to know more about the work that we're doing to turn back AB, those are some ways that you can get additional information and decide whether or not you'd like to be involved.
And we'll put a link to the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies and a link to their Immigrant Women 2 campaign on our website, againstthegrain.org. Karen Musallo, M-U-S-A-L-O, Professor of Law, Founding Director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings College of the Law. Karen, thanks for the information. Thanks for your work. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.